You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
We're talking about a guy whose father, Sadiq Mateen, was running for president of Afghanistan. He was a frequent visitor at the White House, or at least he's been photographed there with presidents. He was a close associate of the Northern Alliance, which was the front group of drug smugglers that the CIA organized to overthrow the Taliban. Sadiq Mateen apparently had some difficulties with some of his handlers, and who knows whether that may have contributed to his son Omar Mateen being selected as the patsy for the false flag operation in Orlando.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. Kevin Barrett. Today's show, recent false flags. Kevin Barrett has taught Arabic, Islamic studies, folklore, African literature, French, and humanities at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and San Francisco State University. He holds a PhD in African languages Arabic with an Islamic studies focus from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is the editor of a trilogy of anthologies on false flag terror. We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, Free Thinkers Question the French 9/11, Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino, and his most recent Orlando False Flag, The Clash of Histories. Today we discuss the Orlando shootings within the context of the strategy of tension and the increasing frequency of false flag terror attacks. Kevin Barrett, welcome.
It's good to be back with you, Bonnie.
You have just published your third anthology on false flag events, Orlando False Flag, The Clash of Histories, that completes a trilogy of anthologies beginning with We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, Freethinkers Question the French 9/11, and Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. In your preface to Orlando False Flag, The Clash of Histories, you write that Bernard Lewis and Samuel Huntington wrote that we are famously living through a clash of civilizations, pitting Islam against the West. This book suggests, on the contrary, that much of the tension afflicting today's world is the product of a clash of histories. What is meant by a clash of histories?
Well, I got that term from Rafiq, who is one of the contributors to this book. And I think the way he's using it is that the word history, we usually think of that to mean what really happened in the past. But, of course, that's the product of storytelling. And if you go back into the etymology of the word history, you find that it used to mean just a narrative, a story. You know, there were stories like the history of Tom Jones, a foundling, and things like that. So the word history has this kind of double sense built into it. On the one hand, it's what really happened in the past. On the other hand, it's the storytelling that constructs our present idea about what really happened in the past. And we have a real clash going on right now between the two principal views of what's really been going on since 9/11, 2001. And the mainstream view is that crazy Muslims keep attacking us, and sometimes they get really lucky, like on 9/11, or in Orlando, for that matter, as we'll get into, and that this has created the so-called war on terror, meaning that we have to go all out on a war footing and kind of suspend the Constitution and double our military budget and have military engagements all over the world to try to stop this plague of terrorism. The other view, the clashing view with that, which is the one I represent, argues that this is really a gigantic hoax, that in fact, well, to start with, you're more than 10 times more likely to drown in your bathtub or to be hit by lightning than to be killed by a terrorist. So there is no statistically significant terrorist threat to Americans whatsoever. We would not be justified in spending one red cent to combat it. Instead, we're spending trillions. In fact, I think a recent study showed multiple trillions is what this war has cost. So this contrasting, clashing, dissident view and I'm one of the people who's pushing it, is that what's really going on is that we've been tricked into believing that there's this terrible terrorism problem, and a lot of it stems from the religion of Islam and Muslims. And so we have to take all these steps that we've taken, wage wars all over the world, kill people with drone attacks, suspend the Constitution, and so on and so forth. And in fact, that has been constructed by storytelling. And the kind of storytelling that has constructed this has been based around false flag events, which are emotionally compelling, powerful, apparent happenings in which we believe that these evil terrorists have killed lots and lots and lots of people. And sometimes maybe lots of people have been killed, but it's actually the whole thing has largely been arranged by the people who are trying to construct this false narrative.
Could you briefly describe the Orlando, Florida Pulse nightclub shooting of June 12, 2016, as reported in the mainstream media? What were we told went on, and what are some of the things that private researchers have discovered?
Well, we were told that a lone Muslim nut, a radical extremist Muslim nut, a guy named Omar Mateen, who happens to be the son of Sadiq Mateen, a very high-level White House and CIA-linked Afghan political player, went into the Pulse nightclub around closing time at 2 a.m. In Orlando, Florida. And he got into a little bit of a shootout, supposedly, on the way in with a guard, but there's not much evidence of that, and nobody was hurt. Once he was inside, we have conflicting official narratives. One version says that he killed most of his 49 total victims and his 53, I think it was, wounded victims pretty quickly, and then retreated with hostages into a restroom where he stayed for, I believe, approximately 3 hours. I think it was. It was either 2 or 3 hours with these hostages. And the police didn't try to come in or interfere until the end of the standoff, which I think was around 4 or 5 in the morning, when police finally got the authorization to enter. And then they used a police armored vehicle to knock down the wall, and people came streaming out. And supposedly Mateen was shot down in a gun battle. So the total number of dead was, I believe, 49. The total number of wounded, 53. And the official number of bullets fired by Mateen was about 200 bullets, meaning that he killed or wounded someone more often than he didn't with each bullet. So that's the official version. And there are all sorts of problems with it, as readers of my book will notice.
Well, then, what are some of the things that private researchers have discovered?
Well, the first item here is that, as the mainstream story admits, 200 bullets with 49 dead and 53 wounded doesn't add up. That would be a feat of shooting. Pretty much, it would be completely unprecedented. Such a thing has never happened. That's way too many victims, way too many accurate shots. But that's really just the beginning. That was the first thing I noticed, was this extraordinarily high count of dead and wounded for around 200 bullets. But then the more we look at this, the more problems we find. For one thing, we were told by the media that this was an Islamophobic, on-gay kind of false flag. We were told that Omar Mateen, like radical Muslims, perhaps Muslims in general, supposedly hates gay people. So he did this out of Islamophobia because he's such an extremist Muslim. Then it emerged very quickly from many, many sources, including his ex-wife, that Omar Mateen was gay himself, and that he had been a regular at the Pulse nightclub, that he had dated many men in the Orlando gay community, and that the FBI was leaning very heavily on witnesses and trying to silence them. They tried to silence Mateen's ex-wife in order to prevent this story that he was gay from getting into the mainstream media. So that, of course, presents a real problem with the official narrative that of a homophobic Islamic attack on gay people. And another issue that's come up, and this has been raised by all sorts of people, including our lead researcher in the book, former CIA clandestine services officer Robert David Steele, that Omar Mateen had an extraordinary background with the black operations intelligence community. He was employed by Wackenhut, or G4S. They had to change their name because Wackenhut became so notorious. That's the outfit that the FBI and CIA says gets called in when a job is too dirty even for them. He worked for this outfit after graduating from a four-year police academy, so he was a trained police officer. And while he was working for Wackenhut, he was doing all sorts of bizarre things that should have gotten him not only fired but prosecuted, such as threatening to have his Al-Qaeda buddies kill his co-worker. That was just one of the many scenes he apparently staged. And we know they were staged because he was not even reprimanded or transferred to a less desirable work site, much less fired or prosecuted. So he was playing the role of a radical Muslim for Wackenhut, even as he was apparently leading this double life as a wild and crazy gay guy. So that's another issue that researchers have found. And another critically important issue is that he was scheduled to fly on June 14th. So he purchased tickets for himself and his family to fly out to visit relatives in the Bay Area, actually. And this seems rather anomalous if, as the official story says, he had already bought the gun and was preparing to do the deed back then. So these are just a few of the issues, but there are many, many more. Robert David Steele, again, he's not just a CIA clandestine services expert, but he actually ran a false flag operation himself for the CIA, in which he tells us nobody got killed, and it wasn't particularly successful in terms of its objectives. He has counted 70 anomalies, indicators, or red flags. And so I, rather than go through all of them, I'll let you point me in whichever direction you like.
I just remembered reading something that Dr. James Tracy posted after this event, that Omar Mateen was actually an actor, and he had an IMDb page in which he was featured in a film called Orlando Shooting, or something like that. And when he posted this, then the citation was taken down. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, I think I saw that. And he was an actor. He appeared in two films, and in one of them, he basically played himself. It was a film, was it about Deepwater Horizon? It wasn't this new one, but he was in a film about some kind of disaster in which he played a security guard, and his role was bad boy. And of course, that's pretty much what he played in quote unquote real life for Wackenhut, otherwise known as G4S, was the bad boy security guard. And he was in another film as well. So yeah, he was apparently an actor, and it's hard to tell where his acting responsibilities ended and his G4S responsibilities begin.
Maybe you should talk very briefly about false flag events. What is the strategy of tension? And are false flag terror events part of this strategy?
Well, the term false flag comes from naval warfare, in which a ship would hoist a flag that didn't represent its true allegiance, so it could get within cannon range or otherwise fool the enemy, or maybe start a war between two other parties. And the strategy of tension is driven by false flag terror attacks, that is, terrorism events which are not carried out by the people who are blamed for them. The strategy of tension was a word coined to describe what was happening in 1960s and 70s Europe under Operation Gladio. Operation Gladio was a Pentagon program run by the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States military, founded by Lyman Lemnitzer, a notorious criminal, and run through NATO. And it essentially created a bunch of terror events in Europe during the Cold War. In fact, all of the most heavily publicized terror events in Europe during the Cold War were, in fact, orchestrated by the U.S. military through Operation Gladio. The Red Brigades was so heavily infiltrated and steered that it was essentially acting as a branch of the U.S. military. They murdered Prime Minister Aldo Moro at the orders of, well, it probably went back to Henry Kissinger. We're not 100% sure of that. The Baader-Meinhof gang in Germany, another notorious terror outfit that killed a lot of people, was also essentially a branch of our own military. And the Brabant shootings in Belgium where people were being shot down on sidewalks and in supermarkets were also being carried out by agents of the U.S. military. And all in all, many hundreds of people were killed in Western Europe, and the total rises into the thousands if we talk about Turkey. The Pope was shot by our own military as a false flag to be blamed on the USSR. So this was a real reign of terror during the Cold War. Its purpose, the strategy of tension, was to create fear and tension in the population so they would vote for right-wing pro-American parties and stop voting for left-wing pro-independence anti-U.S. empire parties. It was a political thing. And today we're seeing the new kind of strategy of tension. The fear and tension is targeted towards Muslims. And the false flag terrorism is used to drive the so-called war on terror, which is really a very nebulous sort of excuse for military intervention all over the world. And it also serves Israeli geostrategic objectives as much as American ones, and probably has a serious Israeli component as well as a U.S.-NATO component.
I'm speaking with author and radio host Dr. Kevin Barrett. Today's show, Recent False Flags. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Why would staged terror incidents target innocent civilians, say women and children, for instance, instead of political enemies of those said to be the terrorists? What's the point?
Well, Vincenzi Vinciguerra, who was an Operation Gladio terrorist employed by American tax dollars through the Pentagon, was actually convicted of killing people as part of Operation Gladio. And he testified in court that you had to kill innocent people, women, children. And he explained that the purpose was to create fear in the population so they would go running towards authoritarian leadership. In fact, targeting non-combatant, civilian, sort of random people is not something that actual national liberation-type terrorists tend to do. For instance, the Palestinian freedom fighters don't randomly target European and American civilians. That would obviously harm their cause, just as the Vietnamese didn't come over to the United States and blow up skyscrapers or shoot people in nightclubs or whatever. That would be a completely insane military strategy. And terrorism is just a military tactic, so it's always used intelligently and strategically. So every terror event must be assumed to be, and virtually always is, orchestrated by the people who benefit from it.
And then again, what is the benefit derived from blowing up innocent civilians?
Well, as Vinciguerra explained, it drives fear in the population. And a fearful population is not going to be thinking critically about its leadership, about the important issues. And most importantly of all, fear in the population drives war and violence. People are by nature essentially defensive. That is, most human beings are not really interested in aggressive violence against others. But they will use violence to protect themselves if they are fearful and feel that they are under threat. So the problem is that the national leaders that want war are not looking for defensive war. Nobody is interested in launching a defensive war. All wars are launched by a more powerful country or entity that's targeting a less powerful country or entity in order to steal its resources. And so, therefore, those who are plotting aggressive war to steal resources from somebody who's weaker have to somehow convince their population that this is actually defensive. So how do you do that? You know, if you're, let's say, the United States and you want to steal half of Mexico's territory and it's 1846, how are you going to convince the American people to just march off and steal Mexico's territory? Well, you orchestrate a fake Mexican invasion. You have Americans run into Mexico and fire up some shots at Mexican troops, and then you have it reported in the media as though the Mexicans attacked the U.S. And so that's what happened. That's how we stole half of Mexico's territory. And then the same thing happened in 1898 with the Remember the Maine incident, which set off the so-called Spanish-American War. Once again, a very, very strong U.S. coveted the lands and resources of a very, very weak Spain. And in order to start that war, essentially American agents blew up the USS Maine. And we now know from the Admiral Rickover study in the 1990s that that ship blew up from within. It did not hit a Spanish mine. It was not attacked by outside Spanish forces. And on, we see the same pattern with the Lusitania incident that drove U.S. involvement in World War I, with the orchestrated eight-point plan that forced the Japanese to attack at Pearl Harbor, with the U.S. fully aware and the British and everybody else fully aware that they were coming and purposely allowing those 2,000 people to be killed in to get us into World War II. The Gulf of Tonkin incident, which didn't happen, but it was reported as a North Vietnamese attack on the U.S. that brought us deeper into Vietnam, and on and on, up through 9/11 and the subsequent acts of false flag terror. So essentially, to have war, you have to have these kinds of events, especially if they target innocent people, it's great. I mean, sometimes they target military people, like at Pearl Harbor. Sometimes there really is an enemy attack, as at Pearl Harbor. But as Vince Aguirre said, the best way to really make the population fearful, so then it will respond by obeying orders and marching off to war, paying high taxes for war, giving up civil liberties, all that sort of thing, you terrorize them by targeting them. That means targeting innocent people, innocent women, children, civilians.
Are there common traits that characterize these violent incidents that terrorize the populace? For instance, are investigations conducted before blame is assigned?
Well, one of the key signs of a likely false flag is that blame is assigned almost instantly. And if it's not a false flag, it may take a very long time for the media to tell us who did it. Examples of blame being assigned far too quickly include, well, with 9/11, just minutes after the first tower was hit, Ehud Barak, the former Israeli prime minister, was in the studios on BBC telling us who did it and what would happen. He said bin Laden did it, and we're going to have to go to war. There'll be a war against Iraq and Afghanistan. That was just minutes after the first plane hit the building. At that time, most people weren't even sure it was even a plane. They had no idea what was going on. So Ehud Barak, who had actually come to America in the spring of 2001, and a lot of evidence suggests that his job was to organize the coming 9/11 attack. Christopher Bolin has written about this in his book, Solving 9/11. Barak just happened to be there in the BBC studios in London in time to be on television minutes after that first plane hit. And we see this pattern over and over and over with the so-called radical Islamic terror attacks driving the war on terror. There's always somebody, usually Israeli-linked, pre-positioned to provide the quick propaganda footage and to assign blame. And likewise, of course, we had the 19 hijackers already identified by the day after through ludicrously improbable means. And we've seen the same thing with many of these other terror attacks as well, such as the Charlie Hebdo attacks, where the French Interior Minister Cazeneuve said the only reason we caught these guys was they dropped their ID cards in their abandoned getaway car, allowing them to ID the perps almost instantly. So if they know who did it instantly, that's always a sign that it's probably false flag.
Right, and I'm thinking that one of the other traits of a false flag, of course, as you've just mentioned, is that the accused will leave their ID behind. I mean, there are many instances of that. And then what about news being reported before it happens? I'm thinking here of one incident with the French President Hollande. Wasn't the news of his speech released before he even made the speech after one of these Paris attacks?
Yes, I believe that was the second Paris attack, November 13th, 11, 13, 15. And I believe it was researcher Oli Damagard who found that the text of Hollande's speech had actually been published on Wikipedia an hour before he made the speech. And there are many glitches like this. For instance, let's see, with Building 7 in 9/11, that's a clear case of a news report that came 20 minutes early. We had the BBC reporting, and actually CNN had reported before that, that Building 7 had collapsed 20 minutes before it actually did at 5:20-something in the afternoon. So there are a number of cases like this. With the JFK assassination, there was a famous one where the Stars and Stripes newspaper in New Zealand published a detailed bio on Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone gunman, the patsy, actually. And they did that too early. Apparently, they hadn't planned for the international dateline. So even before Oswald had been arrested and identified, he had a full bio published by Stars and Stripes in New Zealand. And so these kinds of glitches do happen. And unfortunately, our mainstream media is not interested in exposing them.
And what about terror drills happening at the same time that replicate the specifics of the attack? There are quite a few instances of that, aren't there?
Oh, yes. It happens all the time. Again, with that second Paris terror attack of November 13th, 2015, I believe there was a drill going on that same day that not only mimicked the exact kinds of attacks that we were going to see, such as multiple location shooters and so on, but also the number of victims, I believe, was identical to the number of victims that were actually claimed in the real attacks. So that was another case of an astounding coincidence. And we had reports in the French media of people who were apparently involved in this, talking about it, talking about how they had all the EMTs out and they had all the anti-terror police out. Everybody was out ready to go through their drills. And then the real thing happened. Something similar happened in London on July 7th, 2005, when Peter Power of Visor Consultants went on television in shock. He was astounded and he was shocked that these actual four bombings, which hit three subway locations and one bus, had happened at the precise times and places as the imaginary bombs that were supposed to go off in the terror exercise that he was running the same day for Visor Consultants and an unnamed client. So that's the most extreme example. But there are many other examples, including on 9/11, the 46 drills, war games, and terror exercises associated with 9/11, of which 20-some were actually going on that day, making September 11th, 2001, by far the biggest pre-scripted national security special event day in U.S. history. Webster Tarpley has written quite a bit about that. So, yes, this is a pattern that we repeatedly see, that drills coincide with actual or supposedly actual terror attacks. And I believe the perpetrators do this because it's a way to prepare the actual attack. That is, the people who are working on it in whatever agencies do this may be working next to coworkers who would get suspicious, but then they could say, oh, it's just a drill. And then likewise, planes or, you know, various people and so on can be moved into position by way of drills. And quite often, patsies may actually be people who think they're playing a part in a drill. And then before you know it, they're the ones who are blamed for the event. And then they're always shot dead. And again, over and over, as with Omar Mateen, as with the French false flags, Nice, San Bernardino, and on and on and on, we seem to almost always see these patsies getting shot dead, and therefore not having a chance to defend themselves, not having a chance to have any investigation. That didn't work in Boston, where one of the patsies survived the attempt to shoot him dead, but they had to go back to Plan B then to keep him silenced. They brought in a CIA-linked lawyer, and so Zokhar Tsarnaev, who is clearly innocent of the Boston bombing, which was carried out by Kraft International operators, as photographic and video evidence clearly shows, he's innocent, but he's on death row. So this is the kind of pattern we see repeatedly, these drills, patsies moved into position and usually executed.
I'm speaking with author and radio host Dr. Kevin Barrett. Today's show, Recent False Flags. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. One of these common characteristics, as you've just said, is that the accused are hunted down and killed so that they can't be interviewed. That's a common trait. Also, what about camera evidence not released, withheld, or destroyed?
Yes, it's amazing, isn't it, how every time one of these big terror events happens, there's no video evidence. The CCTV cameras aren't working. Or if they are working, then the national police come and order all of the footage destroyed, which happened in Nice. It's kind of mind-boggling. For instance, on 7/7/2005 in London, there was supposedly, according to the official story, a glitch happened in the tube's security system. And so there was virtually no security footage available that day. And the only thing that's been made public is a blatantly forged image. With the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, once again, we have the story that there's absolutely no CCTV footage because, once again, it malfunctioned. In Paris on November 13th, 2015, with that multiple location shooting and bombing, a series of attacks. Once again, there was a massive failure in security footage. And so there's no security footage available for the Bataclan nightclub, none for the street. And then in Nice, interestingly enough, there actually apparently was some security footage of the alleged truck attack that happened this summer. And that footage was then ordered destroyed by the French National Terror Police. And the local police fought back against that order. I'm not sure how it's been resolved, but the footage is either under lock and key and nobody has seen it, or it's been destroyed.
And then, of course, another a common characteristic of a false flag would be prior surveillance of the accused by governments. Now, that happens quite a bit, doesn't it, where we find out that the person that's being accused of being behind some kind of an attack turns out that the police had been surveilling them sometimes for years.
Yes, that's right. Omar Mateen was under surveillance for a full year by the FBI, supposedly. His ties to the FBI might even be closer than that. In Paris, the alleged Charlie Hebdo terrorist, the Kouachi brothers, were under surveillance by the authorities, and indeed they'd actually been arrested for child pornography, and then that arrest was made to go away, which suggests that they were not just under surveillance, as the authorities admit, but rather they were acting as intelligence assets. And that's a pattern that we often see as well. These so-called terrorists have an amazing ability to travel anywhere they want to, cross borders, walk out of situations that would get anybody else arrested. It's as if they have get-out-of-jail-free cards. For instance, the supposed mastermind of the November 13, 2015 Paris attacks was arrested, or at least pulled over by the police in a car, I believe with two associates, fleeing the scene of the crime outside of Paris. They were pulled over. The car was thick with marijuana smoke, and they were drunk. Interesting fundamentalist Muslims there, but that's how it always is with these attacks. And the police apparently just waved him on. Now, this guy was the most wanted man in Europe. His face was on all the APBs. This was even before this last attack. And here he is, stoned and drunk out of his mind with a full jihadi beard and everything, and he's just waved on. So rather obviously, he did have some sort of get-out-of-jail-free card. Likewise, the Kouachi brothers, who'd been busted for child porn and apparently put on French intelligence payroll, were crossing borders that couldn't have been crossed. They went from Israel into Arab countries that will not let you in with an Israeli passport stamp. Their passport stamps actually appear to have been fabricated as part of their intelligence agency legend. But the official story is they were traveling back and forth to Yemen to train with al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And with Omar Mateen, the alleged perpetrator of the Orlando attack, he took a bunch of mysterious trips, high-end trips that he shouldn't have been able to pay for with his whack-and-hut salary, to Saudi Arabia, where he may have been meeting with people who were involved in setting up the kind of thing he did. So, yes, terrorists like the 9/11 terrorists, who also were traveling all over the world back and forth out of the U.S. on phony work visas when they had no jobs in the U.S. And these were, of course, not real work visas. They were the type of work visa that the CIA gives its assets as a reward for their services. So these 15 Saudis that allegedly hijacked the planes on 9/11 were, in fact, in the U.S. on CIA snitch visas or reward visas. And those visas were special visas that got them in and out of the country as often as they liked. So, yeah, these alleged radical lone wolf, crazy Muslim terrorists with their full jihadi beards tend to be wild and crazy drinkers, drug users, woman chasers, in the case of Muhammad Atta, pork chop eaters, and this loose, wild, and crazy behavior that they're able to do on this money that they're getting from their handlers often involves crossing borders at will, even if they're on the most wanted list.
And what about the use of private mercenaries? Is this a common trait to false flag incidents?
Well, sure, Bonnie, because the mercenaries are the specialists in violence. And if you want a job done, you better call in a professional. So actual mayhem is typically carried out by the professionals. That is, people who are trained in this sort of thing. The folks, you know, who read Soldier of Fortune. And it isn't surprising that sometimes they actually get sighted at the locations where they're doing the damage. For instance, in San Bernardino, we were told that the terrorists, who were, of course, executed before they could talk, before there could be any trials or investigations, well, that consisted of a Muslim couple, and the female member of which weighed about 100 pounds or less. Yet multiple eyewitness accounts tell us that the actual shootings were conducted by three large white paramilitaries. And you can feed that term into your search engine and find those reports, including live interviews with people saying this. And the same thing is true elsewhere, including at the Belle Equipe shooting in Paris, again on November 13, 2015. One of the locations that was attacked was the Belle Equipe nightclub, and their limousine pulled up, and large white paramilitaries got out, started shooting, and jumped back in and drove off, according to multiple eyewitnesses. So it's not that surprising that the professional purveyors of violence who are called upon to do the actual dirty work in these kinds of situations are actual professionals, and then the people who are blamed and then executed are the patsies, and those are usually Muslims.
In your article, Orlando Nightclub Shooting, Another False Flag, you ask who benefits, who would benefit from this Orlando nightclub shooting?
Well, that was the first question I asked myself when the news came across the wires on June 12th. The first thing I thought of was, oh, my goodness, you know, this is perfectly timed to wipe the memory of Muhammad Ali Week out of everyone's minds. You know, Muhammad Ali was really our most celebrated Muslim fighter, not just a fighter in the sense of a boxer, who, as George Carlin said, is paid to beat people up, but also a fighter for truth and justice. He was a very brave man who sacrificed his career to refuse to go to Vietnam, and he spoke out on behalf of victims of injustice and oppression all over the world, including occupied Palestine, where he famously he said, I speak for all American Muslims in calling for the people of occupied Palestine to rise up and drive out the invaders. So he's a strong-willed Muslim, speaking the truth and speaking the views, giving voice to the views that most Muslims hold, but many are afraid to speak publicly. And the whole world was celebrating this guy's life. You know, he had just died a week or something before this, and there was just nonstop adulation of the great Muslim freedom fighter for truth and justice, Muhammad Ali. And then, as if it were inscribed, you know, somewhere in the script, boom, this gigantic event in which one guy shooting 200 rounds supposedly kills 49 people and wounds 53 in this nightclub. Oh, evil radical Muslims hate gay people. That's the propaganda line that they were pushing. That's what this was designed to do. And so people's memories of this positive view of the Islamic freedom fighters standing up for the underdog like Muhammad Ali gets completely shoved deep down into the memory hole. And this new image, this emotionally powerful image, is implanted deeply into people's subconscious. And that image is evil, radical Muslims hate and kill gay people. That was the propaganda message that Orlando was designed to drive home.
What about FBI terror plots and hapless patsies? Have there been many of such incidents?
Well, there's so many that I've lost count. Trevor Aronson, in his book, The Terror Factory, lists 600 cases of alleged Muslim terror plots since 9/11. And virtually every single one of those cases has actually been an FBI terror plot hatched by the FBI, and then they tried to sell it to some hapless Muslim patsy, usually a retarded teenager or some other marginal, unstable, alcoholic, or otherwise troubled and unsophisticated individual. And so in virtually all of these cases, what we have is not Islamic terrorism, it's FBI terrorism. And for details, I urge your listeners to read Trevor Aronson's book, The Terror Factory, which is copiously documented. And he didn't know this when he set out to write the book. He was actually curious about Muslim terror plots post 9/11. And he was shocked, as you will be shocked, to read the book and discover that there aren't any. It's all FBI terror plots.
The Orlando shooter was, quote, on the radar of U.S. officials, but not a target of a specific investigation. What does this indicate, in your opinion?
Well, on the radar is kind of an understatement. You know, we're talking about a guy whose father, Sadiq Mateen, was running for president of Afghanistan. He was a frequent visitor at the White House, or at least he's been photographed there with presidents. He was a close associate of the Northern Alliance, which was the front group of drug smugglers that the CIA, which is the bull goose drug smuggling organization on planet Earth, organized to overthrow the Taliban. Sadiq Mateen apparently had some difficulties with some of his handlers, and who knows whether that may have contributed to his son Omar Mateen being selected as the patsy for the false flag operation in Orlando. And some of this background information is explored in one of the essays in my book, which is by Kader Mohmand, who was the former representative to the United States of the Afghan freedom fighters during the 1980s. And he is not happy with the way Afghanistan has been destroyed by this war that has essentially empowered the drug lords. You know, when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, the first thing it did was set all the drug lords free because they were part of the so-called Northern Alliance and encouraged them to plant. And so the Taliban had shut down the heroin crop and shut down the world's heroin industry. But shortly after the U.S. got control of Afghanistan, suddenly Afghanistan began creating record heroin crops. And Sadiq Mateen was part of that Afghan CIA-linked drug mafia. So Omar Mateen was very much on the radar screen through that of the national security community. And, of course, he was working for G4S, the notorious paramilitary group I already mentioned. And he was investigated for a full year by the FBI, and the investigation then just went away. Likewise, whatever investigation may have been conducted about his threatening co-workers that he was going to have Al-Qaeda kill them, that all just went away, too. So clearly he was a protected asset of some element or elements of the intelligence community.
I'm speaking with author and radio host Dr. Kevin Barrett. Today's show, Recent False Flags. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You conclude this new anthology with an afterword. Are false flags becoming more frequent? Dallas, Baton Rouge, Nice, and Munich. All of the aforementioned incidents took place in July of 2016. What can you tell us about the police shootings in Dallas, Texas on July 7th? And were there similarities with the July 17th police shootings in Baton Rouge, Louisiana?
Well, you know, I haven't done really thorough investigations of these two incidents, but what really jumped out at me just from kind of looking at the surface of the mainstream narrative and the media reporting on this is that in both of these cases, in Dallas and Baton Rouge, we had very convincing reports of multiple shooters, then devolving into blaming a lone nut patsy. And then in both cases, the lone nut patsy gets executed and can't defend himself. Now, you know, maybe there's an innocent explanation for this, but in the case of Dallas, the official version of how the alleged lone nut shooter was killed is highly improbable. They claim that there was some sort of drone-like robot, police-like crawling robot or something that crawled around the corner and blew him up. Robert David Steele, who's an expert in mayhem, says that that's complete BS. It couldn't have happened like that. I don't know for sure. But whenever I see this kind of situation, when we see a very, very credible, these were not just, you know, one or two witnesses said, oh, we thought there might have been multiple shooters. No, there were very firm reports of multiple shooters, including the police announced that they had arrested multiple shooters. So when I see reports like this, I'm skeptical, and I wonder whether there might be some kind of COINTELPRO operation going on. Maybe the Black Lives Matter movement has the powers that be scared, just like Dr. Martin Luther King scared them and got killed for it. And maybe one of the ways that they're fighting back is to try to smear the Black Lives Matter movement by setting up these killings of police officers to be blamed on angry black men to further demonize the kind of so-called angry black men who are the problem with Black Lives Matter. And it wouldn't surprise me if that were the case. I don't think the case there is yet conclusive, but I included it in the book because I think we really do have to, as Cynthia McKinney says, be patriotic and look at these kinds of reports skeptically based on what we already know, that so many of these incidents turn out to be fabricated, state-sponsored false flag terror.
Well, didn't the Dallas police themselves report snipers shooting, multiple snipers? That was in the news, I thought.
Yes, they did. The Dallas police reported multiple snipers, and these were, again, very firm reports. And then they actually reported, I believe, multiple arrests. So you really kind of have to scratch your head on that one to figure out how that all devolved on one patsy that they could just execute. So, yeah, that's a very, very suspicious one. It kind of would fit the script. This is the sort of thing that experts in false flag terror do. They have political goals, in this case, maybe demonize Black Lives Matter and try and, you know, restrain it, keep it from getting too big. And they do it by staging these kinds of bloody public relations stunts.
What about the Bastille Day incident July 14th on the boardwalk in Nice, France? And then again on July 22nd, there was a shopping mall shooting in Munich, Germany. Were there any connections between the Munich and Nice attacks? Were these incidents filmed, and if so, by whom?
Well, that's a very leading question, but that objection is overruled. And let me tell you that, yes, the photographer who captured both of these events, iconic footage that was put out in the global media of both events, it was the same guy, a guy named Richard Guchar. He appears to have been pre-positioned on the balcony in Nice, France, where he captured what was presented to the world as the beginning of the lethal truck attack on the Esplanade in Nice. And then I believe the story may have been revised to say that it was actually in the middle of the attack. I'm not sure. But it was presented to the world as the beginning of the truck attack. So there he was sitting on his balcony in Nice, France. And there's a truck just, you know, driving. And he just picks up his camera and points at the truck. And he gets really lucky. And that turns out that truck is going to go and mow some people down. Very interesting. Well, the same guy, Richard Guchar, shows up again a week later in Munich, Germany. And once again, he's providing the world with the iconic footage of a terror attack. This time it's the Munich shopping mall shooting. Now, that may be one coincidence too far for a lot of people, but you haven't heard the half of it yet, because it turns out that he's married to Einat Wolf. Einat Wolf is a former advisor to the Israeli prime minister. She is a top Israeli operator. She's linked to the think tank WINEP, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which is a leading neocon think tank that has officially called for false flag terror events. WINEP's director Patrick Clausen famously made a video where he gave a speech calling for a false flag attack to start a war with Iran. And he went through basically the same history I've gone over in this interview, Bonnie, about how every war the U.S. has gotten into has required a trigger event to do it. You know, he says we couldn't invade Mexico until, you know, we had that shootout. We couldn't fight Spain until the Maine blew up. You know, we couldn't get into World War One until the Lusitania went down. We couldn't get into World War Two until Pearl Harbor. We couldn't get into Vietnam until the Gulf of Tonkin. And we won't be able to start our war with Iran, which we avidly desire, until the trigger event happens. He's on record saying this. Now, Einat Wolf, the husband of Guchar, the photographer who was there providing propaganda footage of these two terror attacks within the same week in Nice and then over in Munich, she's part of that think tank that calls for false flags. So just over-the-top shamelessness really seems to describe some of these people who put their same operative, Richard Guchar, on the balcony in Nice to film that attack. And then they put him at the shopping mall in Munich less than a week later to film that attack. If anybody thinks that this is a coincidence and that his marriage to Einat Wolf is also a coincidence, I'm afraid that person is a crazy coincidence theorist.
Well, you know, I believe that is the footage that came out right after the Nice incident. And it said, here is a film of this lorry or this truck mowing people down. And I watched this clip over and over and over again. It didn't show any such thing. All it showed was a truck moving.
No kidding. Well, this is a very strange pattern, Bonnie. We see this repeatedly as well. They told us that this was this awful, horrific footage of this truck mowing people down. I heard Sean Hannity repeat that kind of statement many, many, many times as I watched the kind of live coverage of the aftermath of that attack, or alleged attack, and we never actually saw any footage. This footage just shows a truck starting up and heading off down the street, basically. So doesn't that remind you of the footage of the police officer being shot point blank in the head with an AK-47 after the Charlie Hebdo supposed massacre? Only there's no such shooting. That video was likewise presented to the world as this horrific, bloody footage, discretion necessary. And then they even said we had to cut out the key moment of this footage because it was too bloody. Well, the uncensored version of that video shows that rather than showing a ninja terrorist running up to a cop who's lying on the sidewalk and putting an AK-47 up to his head and blowing his brains out, that no such thing happened. The guy dressed as the terrorist runs up to the cop on the sidewalk and then aims the gun a meter away from the head and fires what appears to be a blank round of cotton or paper, kicking up a little dust over on the sidewalk and leaving the guy's head completely unscathed. And yet to this day, the French government tells us that that policeman was executed on that sidewalk, a blatant falsehood. So they got away with it, and then they cut out the portion that showed that it was a non-shooting. It was a blank round fired away from the head. And likewise, with this truck attack footage, they're whipping people up into a hysteria of hatred of Muslims by saying, oh, this crazy Muslim, he mowed people down. We've got this horrific, bloody footage. And here it is. And people see it, and, you know, they kind of remember what they've been hypnotically programmed to remember. But you can prove to them that no such footage exists. And that's another problem with these events is that there's virtually never any actual footage of what supposedly happened. This Esplanade Nice is full of people with cell phone cameras, smartphones, and it's got all of that CCTV coverage. Not one image of the actual attack has ever emerged from anywhere. Likewise, with the Bataclan nightclub shooting, you know, we're told that this packed nightclub during a rock concert was shot up with horrific carnage and mayhem, and yet there's not a single actual cell phone image or any other kind of convincing image of any of that happening. And likewise in Orlando, the security cameras just happened to be malfunctioning that night. And we had, you know, what, the 200 plus people in the nightclub, and not a single convincing image has emerged from inside or even outside the nightclub. This is all very, very, very strange.
No, that's right. They tell you what you're seeing, but it doesn't exist. It's not there. The other thing that struck me as so odd about Nice right away is that there were multiple pictures on the internet of people, I guess relatives or tourists, sitting down beside what we're told are dead bodies with drapes over them. And I thought to myself, well, this is supposed to be a crime scene. These are supposed to be dead bodies, but they're letting people stroll through there and sit next to these bodies. I mean, crime scenes aren't handled that way, are they? Even in France.
Well, no. You have to ask yourself, where's the yellow police tape, et cetera, et cetera. And we see this pattern as well, that rather than being treated as crime scenes, they're treated as essentially media public relations studios. This happened at the apartment of the Patsys, who were executed in San Bernardino, the Muslim couple there who took the blame for something that they obviously didn't do. At their apartment, shortly after that event, the media, the police essentially stepped back and allowed the media to come in and completely ransack the apartment, just trashed it. And so that apartment no longer had any evidentiary value whatsoever after that happened. And this would not be what any real police would do if there was an actual crime involved. And so it's not surprising to see this kind of activity at Nice.
Tell us about the reporting of Hisham Hamza. Who is he and what happened to him?
Well, Hisham Hamza is a French investigative reporter. He runs the website panamza.com. And I think he's the best investigative reporter in Paris right now. He broke many of the most important stories about the Charlie Hebdo event and then that subsequent French false flag on November 13th, 2015. Hisham Hamza was actually arrested for his reportage on the Bataclan nightclub shooting. And that's an interesting story in itself. As we mentioned, there's a real shortage of any kind of actual footage or photographs of what actually happened at any of these terror events. But there is one and only one picture of dead bodies in Paris on November 13, 2015. Now, think about that. We had a multiple location attack. We had a bombing, supposedly, at the French stadium, the Stade de France. We had shootings at the Belle Equipe nightclub and inside the Bataclan Theater, where the worst casualties were, so we're told. And yet not one single dead body except one photo. And that photo shows a bunch of bodies, or parrot bodies, lying in kind of disheveled positions on the floor of the Bataclan nightclub. And somehow, a huge heart shape has been drawn on the floor of the Bataclan in blood. It's about maybe, about 4 feet, 5 feet thick, this heart shape. So the line that drew the heart on the floor of the Bataclan nightclub would have to be one of those things they use to wash the floor in Walmart that leaves like a 4 foot trail of liquid. Well, imagine somebody using one of those to paint a 4 foot thick blood heart on the floor of the Bataclan. So we see that blood heart and we see a bunch of bodies on the floor of the Bataclan. That's the only image of any dead bodies in Paris that day. And where did that come from? Well, turns out it was tweeted into existence by an Israeli-based think tank. Surprise, surprise. It's the Israelis supplying us with our iconic terror images once again. And Isham Hamza tracked down this photo and found who tweeted it into existence, again, an Israeli think tank, and he published the story. And with his story, he published that photo. Well, the next thing you know, he was under arrest. The charge was that he was impugning the dignity of the victims. It turns out there's a law in France that they can use to try to suppress pictures of people who are victims of terror events. Anyway, Hisham Hamza was arrested for publishing this photo in his news story showing that the real criminals under French law, the people who had actually taken and disseminated that photo, were in fact members of a right-wing neocon Israeli think tank.
Kevin Barrett, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Bonnie. Keep up the great work.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Dr. Kevin Barrett. Today's show has been Recent False Flags. Dr. Barrett has taught Arabic, Islamic studies, folklore, African literature, French, and humanities at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and San Francisco State University. He holds a PhD in African languages, Arabic, with an Islamic studies focus from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is the editor of a trilogy of anthologies on false flag events. We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, Free Thinkers Question the French 9/11, Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino, and his most recent, Orlando False Flag, The Clash of Histories. He has lectured extensively in Morocco, Turkey, and Iran, as well as the U.S. and Europe. Kevin Barrett's radio programs are archived at noliesradio.org. Visit his website at truthjihad.com. That's truthjihad.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yaral Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G. And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now, the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, an all-new episode featuring an all-old monologue by the great radio storyteller Gene Shepherd. If you missed it in 1962, I hope you'll stay tuned. I'm familiar with three fine radio humorist storytellers. One was Garrison Keillor, of course. Back in the 1980s, I'd catch his News from Lake Wobegon monologues each week on NPR, usually skipping the rest of his two-hour variety show. Even better than Keillor was the Canadian Stuart MacLean. He had a weekly show on CBC Radio called The Vinyl Cafe. I caught it on shortwave in the 1990s. MacLean is now dead, and Keillor is collecting unemployment. Their common ancestor was Gene Shepherd. Shepherd flourished in the 1960s. Late at night, I think 5 days a week, he did a 45-minute show on WOR AM and FM in New York City. All 45 minutes of each show was his monologue. Naturally, the quality varied. At his best, though, Shepherd was very good indeed. He was a wry and insightful critic of the vices and follies of Americans, mostly the follies. Twice in the past, I've condensed a Shepherd monologue and put it on New World Notes. I do so for a third time today. The piece is about, quote, "the thin thread of the divinely absurd that runs through all of us," unquote. For example, our elephant leg umbrella stands, our bed and washing machine vehicles, the rationalizations we offer to justify our love of space flights and of war, and our favorite rhetorical question, who's covering up? From his broadcast of September 19, 1962, here is Gene Shepherd.
Over the weekend, I spent about 3 hours watching these canned television shows, you know, the realistic kind, where there's a scene where the cops wind up chasing the guy around the roof. Have you ever seen, you know, around the roofs of the buildings up and down the west side there over by the docks? And they shoot it out, and the lovely girl who winds up getting involved in the third reel, he's tearing down the fire escape, and he jumps into the room there, and he's always in the room with her, you know, this beautiful girl. Well, I saw at least seven of those over the weekend, see, and they're running around on the roofs. And I came to a conclusion there. These are called realistic television shows because they're shot on real fire escapes and on real roofs. Wouldn't it be fantastic if life really was like that? I mean, really, wouldn't it be? If every 20 minutes you hear them shooting it out up on the roofs, you know, you go over in the 40s there, over by the roof, pow, 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 and Rocco the Lip, you see, is swinging up and down the fire escapes, and there's a beautiful girl wearing a shawl. Oh, Rocco, Rocco, please, I love you. Wouldn't it be wild? Oh, and think of the great headlines, and think of the wonderful newspaper stories. Every day you could pick up the newspapers, you know, and there would be all those stories in the paper. But all these fantastic things, and invariably, in every story, it would say that Rocco the Lip, while he was being chased up this alley, ran into this beautiful girl who had just come in on the boat from Italy someplace, and she was a beautiful girl, had a strange, striking resemblance to Elizabeth Taylor. And she fell instantly in love with him, and she didn't know he was a crook, but nevertheless, but once in the great while, though, something pops up right out of the paper that makes all of that jazz look like kid stuff, but kid stuff. And you never know where it's going to happen. Now, oh, yes, by the way, before we go any further, I would like to say that tonight's text is not for women and children. And if you fall into either one of those categories, I suggest you go down to, WPAT, maybe. They've got some nice ear-to-ear music. I imagine QXR now has a nice Haydn string quartet on. A couple of other stations got these gigantic recorded fist fights with these guys hollering through their nose. You might like that. And, you know, you got a lot of things you can do. You don't have to. So please, without kicking chairs over anything, please leave now. Now, getting back to our text here, did you read that wild story over the weekend? Now, I tell you how I happened to read it. I was walking along 3rd Avenue, and you know, along 3rd Avenue, way over there on the east side there, all kinds of little places where they sell used Victorian lamps and elephant's foot umbrella stands. Hey, by the way, did you ever see an elephant's foot umbrella stand? A real one? Well, one time I'm in an auction, and it's a great auction. And I really dig going to auctions, especially auctions when they're selling some old recluse's estate. And, you know, they've got all this wild stuff there, and they're selling it all out. And the auctioneer is trying to make everybody believe that it's wonderful stuff. And I'm sitting down in the crowd on the camp chairs. You know, they have these little stores with the camp chairs all sitting there. And up on a little stage is the auctioneer. And he's selling the estate of this well-known, very ancient, and very eccentric recluse who lived on the outside of Cincinnati, and he made all kinds of dough in the yeast business. So right there, you know, he's got a lot of stuff going. You can tell it, right? He made yeast. So this old gentleman had passed into the great beyond, and he left behind him a collection of effluvia, the like of which the average pack rat could not even comprehend. So anyway, I'm sitting there, and they got this big chandelier up there, and the auctioneer is up there. He's pounding away with a gavel, you know, and all of his assistants are bringing stuff up. And he says, and now we have number 172 in the catalog, number 172 in the catalog, a genuine pachyderm, a genuine African pachyderm umbrella stand, a genuine African pachyderm umbrella stand. This is a pure piece of Victorian artwork, a very rare piece of Victorian artwork, and probably the like of which will seldom be seen again on the face of the earth. A beautiful piece which undoubtedly will go for hundreds of dollars more than we are asking for it this afternoon, number 172 in the catalog. Will you please bring it up? Well, they put up on the stand there an elephant's foot. Actually, it was an elephant's leg. Oh, boy, cut off at the knee. And there is this elephant's leg standing with the toenails. A real elephant's leg. And sticking out of the elephant's leg there, they had hollowed it out somehow. I don't know how they hollowed it out, and they had a brass thing set down in the middle of it. And sticking out of it were a couple of sample canes. And he said, number 172, a genuine pachyderm umbrella stand, genuine pachyderm umbrella stand. I guess he was using the phrase pachyderm because he figured that everybody, if they didn't look really sharply enough, would think it was teak wood or something else equally acceptable outside of an elephant's knee. Have you ever looked at an elephant's knee, really? Cut off there at the top with an umbrella sticking out? So he's going, well, I'm looking at this thing, and I think, by George, you know, you can't give up hope. You just can't give up hope. And over the weekend, I'm walking along on 3rd Avenue. They got all these shops where they're selling stuff like that, you know. They're selling little paddle wheel steamers, and they're selling all kinds of just effluvia. You know, all the junk. Can you imagine what it would be like if mankind somehow disappeared from the face of the earth tomorrow and left all his stuff behind him? Just left it, you know. Just even better than that, I would love to see a pile of all the junk, just the junk of mankind piled up. I wonder how high it would reach, this pile, how big the base would be, how much it would weigh, and how many hopes it would contain, how many distorted, wild, strange, beautiful, exquisite, circumscribed dreams all piled up there. With those plastic streetcars and those leather whales and those elephant's toes. Oh, boy. While I'm walking down there, I'm looking in the window, see, and I figure, well, this is a part of man that has no relationship to his action. You follow me here? It's the stuff like you drip off. You know what I mean? It just sort of it's the slough off of man. It doesn't have any real relationship to what he does.
We have here a news item, dateline London, February 15th. A court in Aldershot ruled today that if you want to drive your bed through the streets, you must display L or learner plates, obtain proper automobile insurance, hang license plates at either end, and install a braking system. Richard Brown, a 19-year-old student who did not follow these rules, was fined the equivalent of $36 and suspended from driving beds or cars for 1 month. He drove his bed, powered by a motorcycle engine, for 2.5 miles through Farnborough 5 months ago. The processional committee that fined him was also held for aiding and abetting Mr. Brown. Coincidentally, today the student who is now in the Royal Aircraft Establishment is the only known bedstead driver in the country. He was barred from the road. However, we were watching and will watch this youth's procedure in the future with a great deal of interest. All together now. All together. Hold it there. Hold it, all of you. Hold it. Stop it. Stop. Oh. Now. It's just that. Emotionalism will get us nowhere. Did I tell you about the time the lady... Of course, this is the kind of thing that you don't like to tell children. If there are any children awake, all I have to say is that you're going to learn it somewhere. And there was this lady who lived out in Cincinnati. I'll just tell you the true story of it. I might as well lay it right out here on the line. There was a lady one time when I was working in Cincinnati, and I saw the incident happen. I will never forget it because it was one of those things, you know. It wouldn't make the Reader's Digest, but let me tell you, it made my psyche. It also made my day. I was walking, you know, Cincinnati is a very hilly town, you know, very up, you know, up, down, so on. And I'm going uphill one day on Vine Street, and you won't believe this, but I saw a lady who seemed to be otherwise normal and all right, riding in an automatic washer down the middle of Vine Street in Cincinnati, going downhill against the wind. This chick went through two lights and didn't do anything but just sit and wave at people. Well, I saw her go past, you know. You're interested in what? Well, it was a Maytag. And I waved at her when she went past. And she was sitting in the clothes dryer compartment. You know, they have two compartments. She's sitting in the clothes dryer compartment. And somehow I had the feeling that she had had a companion when she started out. And he stopped off somewhere. And they just went right on, disappeared in the distance, and I never heard another word about them. I saw it happen. I was expecting to read about it in the paper, but you know they hush up the real stuff. Everybody's covering up. By the way, are you covering up? Oh. Stop cutting out, you guys. Speaking of covering up... Oh, well, you see, the reason I told the women and children to get out, and I feel very good about it now, since it's quite obvious that the theme that came out was the theme that we had calculated would all along, and that's that thin thread of the divinely absurd which runs through all of the actions of all of us. You don't think for a minute that big countries, I don't care, name any big country, really wants to disarm? Do you really? Why, that's all that history's ever been about, is wars and what happened just after them. No, seriously. It's like telling some guy whose whole world has been based on killing cockroaches that from now on he's got to give up killing cockroaches. Stop it. No, seriously, it's not going to work. And it's interesting to note that every time there is a disarmament, any kind of disarmament talk, everybody gets all flustered. Everyone suspects a trick on the other guy's part, of course. And so, naturally, people disarm disarm in the mind, and then they arm more in reality to prevent any such tricks like this happening.
It sort of piles up one after the other until finally we wind up with tiny little bursts of impatience that have nothing at all to do with disarmament or armament. It's just kind of the bubble festering to the top, the boil on the of the psyche. Just pops like that, you know. And there's the this little thing, you know, comes out of the news. I mean, just this, you know, the letters to the editor. It says, Brooklyn, won't the Transit Authority do something about them fans? Why don't they do something about them fans and the new IRT and BMT cars? They've been in operation all winter. Signed a frozen sardine, rotten bums. Hold it there, rotten bums. It's just a lot of talk. I mean, I'm all over. The world is, in fact, composed of talk. So everybody, we're going to shoot this rocket up now, you know, with a guy in it. And so everybody talks about all the scientific information we're going to get. That isn't why we're doing it. We want to see if we can shoot a rocket up. It's like kids, you know, when a kid is going to do something, when he's going to throw a rock up in the air to see how high it goes, he doesn't try to pretend, you know, that what he's doing it is to measure air currents on rocks. You know, he just runs the rock, you know, lets her go, you know. Well, as man gets older, he does the same thing. He throws rocks up in the air, or he breaks windows, which is the equivalent of a war. But as he gets older, being mature, he has to learn all kinds of ridiculous rationalizations for it. This is a kind of maturity, you know? We call it maturity. So he invents all these economic things, and he invents all these wild, beautiful stories. Like, we have to have the information on the upper air currents on the sporadic E layer there, up around the Van Allen belt. We've got to have that information. So nobody knows why, you know, but we wind up, well, putting $87 billion into a gigantic rock to throw up, and I can only say, fine. I can say there's nothing wrong with that, actually. Because what else is there to do on the Earth anyway, really? Because this is the kind of talk that women, I'm not quite sure, understand, you know? Because I don't think they have the same kind of itch that men have. That the itch that men have to throw things as far as they can be thrown, to fly up as high as you can fly, to jump as high as you can jump. All these things are tied up, oh boy, wow, biologically, psychologically, and everything else, with the problem of being male. Women don't have this problem, obviously. They have others. But what they have, you see, men do not understand in an equal measure. Now, I'm sure that all the women who are listening say, what does he mean? I understand men. Oh, no. No, you don't. Any more than the man really understands your basic motives. We have a few little areas of common boundary we share, men and women, a few areas of common discussion points. But it's like two, do you understand what I mean, Ed? It's really like two races sending notes to each other, written in two different languages, but vaguely written the same way, you know? So here we're going to send these things up. And I think that more and more, of course, it's not a matter of thinking, I know this is a fact, but more and more psychologists are becoming interested in mankind as a whole rather than the individual ill. And more and more, they're beginning to impinge or to dissect that little area there, that little itch that mankind has had to throw things up as high as they can throw it, to see what'll happen, just to see what'll happen. You know, that explains a lot. If you do something and you say, well, I just wanted to see what would happen. That's right. But what does it explain, you see? It doesn't really explain why you want to see what would happen. And so this incessant, insensate drive for knowledge and for understanding of the physical universe has led us into some very interesting paths. But we've never really explained why we want to know these things, really. Now, there can be some very very loose, broad generalizations, and I might say rationalizations. For example, it betters the lot of man on Earth. Do you really believe that? Do you really believe you're happier than, say, somebody who lived 500 years ago? Really happier? On the other hand, you see, the guys who live 500 years from now are going to have things you don't know about. Are you unhappy about it? Do you feel a terrible sense of being cheated because you don't have the instantaneous telepathic method of non-communication which people will have in the year 2750? Do you think Washington felt cheated because he never saw Gunsmoke? Seriously, you know? But we like to think they did, you know? That the poor old Jefferson left this mortal coil feeling cheated. Right, George? He just missed out. Just missed out on Vista Vision. If he just stuck around, he might have seen it. And yet, you see, the interesting problem here is one, again, of time and space. The time you occupy a certain amount of cubic inches of space versus the time and space occupied by somebody else at another point on the graph, just as a big long line there. But nobody quite understands why we have this. No, they don't. They really don't. Now, a lot of people are going to come up with glib answers, but no one has really explained that one interesting facet of all of us. And that's this thing to know everything. Just see what it would do, you know? Just see what it would do. No one really knows about this. And if you're going to tell me, come up and say, well, they're doing this because, you know, if they find out how it is on Saturn, they will discover how they can better the lot on Earth. Oh, come on. Everybody wants to go to Saturn just to see what Saturn's like, that's all. Why don't we just admit it? We want to see what's there. Why do we have to come up with all this, you know, this jazz? Maybe they figured if we said the truth, no one would pay for it. But I suspect they would pay for it quicker. If you laid it out, you know. They said, we want to shoot a rocket up. See how high we can shoot one up. Let's get the dough up here. We're going to shoot this big one up there as far as it can go. And I would pay. But if they come up, you know, and they want to tell me we want to find out about the cosmic rays and about the number of times the gamma ray bounces off the number three E'2 shield. You know, come on, lay off. I mean, after all, my life is short. I just want to see how high you can shoot it. I'm sorry, that's my attitude towards it, which is a terrible attitude, you know. I suppose I should have the proper 20th century attitude, which is the non-romantic or the academician attitude, where I could couch all my secret yearnings in very involved technical language, which when all boiled down says we want to shoot it up in the air. That's what it really boils down to. We want to find out. Of course, we explain, we have gamma rays, we go into quantum mechanics, we go into the whole routine, you see, to kind of hide the whole thing. It's like a giant speakeasy we're running of the mind, you know, that everybody pretends that everything else is going up, but what he really wants is a drink. That's all. I want a drink. We rationalize all over the place. And I'm, of course, on the other hand, if people ever would admit why they have wars, for example, we might begin to make some progress towards not having them. You know, any good psychologist will tell you that the minute a man who has got a fixation, say, for example, an alcoholic, admits that he has one, really admits it, you know, I says, well, all right, now, where do we go from here? Then there might be a chance of going, but obviously no guarantee of a cure. But there is a chance. But we never admit this. I mean, you can't get anybody hardly ever to admit that. Why? Oh, what do you mean? Go to war? We get a kick out of that, all that shooting, all that hollering, all them fireworks, and people yelling and fist fighting, all that, you know? Is there one among you here who, if you saw a fist fight across the street, wouldn't be strangely drawn toward it? Huh? And don't come up and tell me, well, it's because, you know, you're against war now because you're afraid you're going to get hit in the eye. Oh, no, I don't think so either. I think it's how you get hit in the eye. Isn't there one among you who never to himself has said, you can see yourself charging up the hill there at San Juan Hill, you know? And Teddy Roosevelt's hauling charge, and you're running up there behind him, you know, and you take this ball through your shoulder, and you continue to struggle up there, carrying the flag aloft. Come on. You know it's true. You know, one of the saddest sights of all is this little 97-pound weakling standing on the library steps saying how much he hates football players.
Does he really? Or does he hate non-football players even more? It's very complicated, you know. It gets a, why don't they turn them fans off on the BMT? Who's covering up, Wagner? Wise guy. I know how this works. Boy, nobody's going to tell me how it works. I know how it works. They're not covering up. They're not telling you nothing. You don't think they're going to tell you everything about what that thing is going to do when it gets up there, do you? Let me tell you, they're covering up. Who's covering all them guys in Washington, everybody, the big shots? What about that match? You heard about that match that they invented? You light it once, and in fact, you can light it all the rest of your life. It's a match that lasts a lifetime. They bought that one up, boy, and stuck it away in a safe. You heard of, listen, you heard about that guy that invented the motor that runs on water? They bought that one up, stuck it away in a safe. They're not letting nothing out, them guys. Not giving you nothing. They're smart. How'd they make all their dough? How can they sell their gas? Huh. Yeah, they're wise guys. Let me tell you, 15 cents fare on a subway? Let me tell you, Jack, it's going to be 20 cents before the year is out. And why? Who's getting all that dough? Who's sticking all that dough in his pocket, huh? I'll do it tomorrow. Yes, I will. Well, you think not, you watch me. Now, this is a common attitude. You know the attitude? Is there anyone among you who hasn't heard about the carburetor that gets 40 miles to the gallon of gas? And they bought it up from this inventor? They bought it up? Yeah, I know. You got it in a safe. Speaking of the safes, boy, I'll tell you who's got a loaded one. You ought to drop by down to the Mandarin house. Wise apple. The Mandarin house on 13th Street between 6th and 7th. Who are they? Who are they? What do you mean, who are they? All them guys in Washington, the big guys, the big shots, guys with all the dough. Who are they? You know who they are. Mandarin house. Some of the best Chinese food in this whole man's eastern seaboard. And they're open every night. By George, till midnight. They are. They got everything down there. They got all the whole works there. They're open 7 days a week. What do you mean, who are they? You know who they are. Stop it. You're pushing again. They don't tell you nothing, Mac. Crying out loud. Keep your knees loose. Some nights, it's awful, awful dark. You know, just remember that. Just remember that elephant foot. And from time to time, remind yourself of the man in the snake house. And maybe you'll understand.
Gene Shepherd from his show on WOR of September 19, 1962. And from Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. You can find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimi non carborundum, keep your knees loose, remember that you are not alone, and please come back again next week. Till then.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No, it's your head.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The focus of the show today will be on the 9/11-based war in Syria. We, along with our European, Saudi, and Israeli allies, are arming, funding, supporting, and providing medical treatment to al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, ISIS in Syria, while also pretending to be fighting them. It's a proxy war to destroy Syria and eventually Iran. And here's a reminder that the war in Syria was planned probably prior to 9/11 and has nothing to do with freedom and democracy. General Wesley Clark will explain it to you here.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, No. He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to al-Qaeda?" He said, No. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today. And he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran."
The corporate media, and even some of the so-called alternative media, are not telling the truth about what's going on in the Middle East, and especially currently in Syria. The omissions, distortions, and outright lies, by some, are truly astounding. Here's what longtime Middle Eastern journalist John Pilger has to say about the media and Syria. And the clip you're about to hear is from RT, called "Going Underground." And the host is Afshin Ratanzi. And here he is with John Pilger.
What was your reaction when you first heard of the Anglo-American-French missile attacks on Syria?
It's built on a series of, I would call them, lies, fabrications.
The chemical attack on Douma, Theresa May clearly said, "This is why Britain has to go in and fire."
I don't think anything Theresa May says is to be believed, frankly. She's yet to convince us that she has a right to be believed, because almost everything to do with foreign policy has shown to, in the end, if you take the Salisbury attack, that is unraveling so fast. For example, the OPCW report on this, which is not reported, include a laboratory report from its major laboratory in Switzerland, which said this wasn't a nerve agent, this wasn't Novichok, it was something entirely different.
You're talking about the Wiltshire attack.
We're talking
the
about the Wiltshire, so it's the Salisbury attack, but they are connected because it leads then to the attack on Syria. There is overall a campaign against Russia. This is a very long campaign. It's been going on since the Russian Revolution. But it's intensified in terms of its propaganda in a way I'd never known. I've never known journalism to be so distorted in order to serve this propaganda. I mean, the attack on Duma was based on, when I called it a lie, when you look at the available evidence, the real evidence, the evidence that barely sees the light of day, then there's no justification for it whatsoever. There's no real evidence of a chemical attack. So what we're seeing is the most intense campaign of propaganda, at least since the Iraq, the build-up to the Iraq War in 2003. It comes from a great tradition. It comes from 1945, the cover story for dropping two atomic bombs, later discredited, right through to the beginning of the Vietnam War, the Gulf of Tonkin. So we had years of misery and devastation in Vietnam built on a lie. When are we going to understand this? When are we going to understand there's an historical pattern? And we're seeing that played out now almost through the propaganda that's presented as news.
I think one could argue that many mainstream media journalists have short-term memories, perhaps, but they are handed, as they have always been handed, press releases from government that routinely say Russia has obviously invaded an area of Europe, and now they're being told we have proof that they have launched a chemical attack on English soil, first time since World War II, and the journalists say our governments cannot possibly be lying about such a serious event.
I've been a journalist for a long time. I've covered many wars. I've covered the First Cold War. I've covered it from the Soviet Union. I've covered it from the United States. I've worked all over the world. I'm a reporter. I would say there is a pseudo-journalism now. The kind of journalism you described, I wouldn't describe as journalism. To simply write down and swallow what governments tell you is the very antithesis of what real journalism is. Fortunately, we still have it in the great honorable exceptions, the mavericks, like Robert Fisk, whose single report from Duma showed almost without doubt the whole thing was a farce. He interviewed a doctor who'd worked at this particular facility. There was no evidence. The doctor made a mockery of Macron's and May's and claims. We have Seymour Hersh now, who can't be published in his own country. He has to be published in Germany, probably the greatest investigative reporter in the world. Hersh, last year, his own reporting, his own investigation, made mockery of these so-called chemical attacks. I've never known a time when so-called, as you describe it, mainstream, surely a satirical term, mainstream journalism has been so integrated into a propaganda barrage. And that propaganda campaign, at the moment pointed right against Russia, suggests to me that it's the beginning of a kind of another march on Russia, that the surrounding of Russia with bases, with American bases, with NATO missiles, the provocations day after day suggest this. In Syria, where basically the Russians and the Syrians have succeeded, they've won. The rebels, most of whom are jihadists and extreme Islamicists, supported by the United States, supported by Britain, are still presented as a credible opposition within Syria. But the whole point of this is to take Syria from the Russians since the 1950s. If you read the documents, you go back and read the declassified MI6 dispatches from Syria. They've been trying to do this since the 1950s. Syria hasn't been controlled in the same way that Iran hasn't been controlled. I hope this is not the last stage. I don't think it is, because in Syria, it appears there's a major defeat. And what we're seeing is a reaction to that.
And here's what Canadian investigative journalist Ava Bartlett, who's been on the ground in Syria, has to say about corporate media coverage of the situation in Syria. She's responding to a question by an American reporter.
When you talk about the Syrian people and what the Syrian people want, how can you quantify that? Do you have any independent surveys where you can actually document that? And secondly, you talk about the corporate media, the Western media, the lies, and all of this. Could you explain what you think might be the agenda from us in the Western media, and why we should lie, why the international organizations on the ground should lie, why we shouldn't believe all these absolutely documentable facts that we see from the ground, these hospitals being bombed, these civilians who are talking about the atrocities that they have been experiencing? How can you justify calling all of us liars?
Sure. I mean, there are certainly honest journalists amongst the very compromised establishment media. Let's start with your second question. So, international organizations on the ground. Tell me which ones are on the ground in Eastern Aleppo. Yeah, okay, I'll tell you. There are none. There are none. These organizations are relying on Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is based in Coventry, UK, and which is one man. They're relying on compromised groups like the White Helmets, which let's talk about the White Helmets. The White Helmets were founded in 2013 by a British ex-military officer. They have been funded to the tune of $100 million by the US, UK, and Europe, and other states. They purport to be rescuing civilians in eastern Aleppo and Idlib, yet no one in eastern Aleppo has heard of them. And I say no one, bearing in mind that now 95% of these areas of eastern Aleppo are liberated. The White Helmets purport to be neutral, yet they can be found carrying guns and standing on the dead bodies of Syrian soldiers. And their video footage actually contains children that have been recycled in different reports. So you can find a girl named Aya who turns up in a report in month, say, August, and she turns up in the next month in two different locations. So they are not credible. The SOHR is not credible. Unnamed activists are not credible. Once or twice, maybe, but every time, not credible. So your sources on the ground, you don't have them. As for your agenda, not your, but the agenda of some corporate media, it is the agenda of regime change. How can the New York Times, I was reading it this morning, or how can Democracy Now!, which I was reading the other day, maintain until this day that this is a civil war in Syria? How can they maintain until this day that the protests were unarmed and nonviolent until, say, 2012? That is absolutely not true. How can they maintain that the Syrian government is attacking civilians in Aleppo when every person that's coming out of these areas occupied by terrorists is saying the opposite? How do I quantify the support of the Syrian people? The elections. In 2014, the Syrian people held elections. The point being, overwhelmingly, the people support President Assad. There are people that want change in the government. We're not pretending they don't want change. Everybody wants change. But in terms of support of the government, the point is they don't see President Assad as the problem. They see the problem as terrorism. They see elements of problems in the system that they have there, but President Assad, they don't see as the problem. They actually overwhelmingly support him. So I'm basing it on their choice in their leader, and I'm basing it on my interactions with people in Syria.
And now we're going to hear from Ben Swan from the show Truth in Media. And this video is called Who's Funding the White Helmets? And here he is, Ben Swan.
As the U.S. moves closer toward all-out war with Syria, a lot of what our government seems to base its intelligence on, especially claims of chemical weapon use by the Syrian government, is an impartial humanitarian group called the White Helmets. You've no doubt heard of the White Helmets. They've been praised in the media as heroes and have reportedly saved more than 100,000 lives as of April of this year. But who are the White Helmets really? Are they a legitimate organization? Or are they pawns funded for the purpose of regime change? Let's give it a reality check you won't get anywhere else. Despite a recent U.S. funding freeze for humanitarian aid for Syria, the U.S. continues to fund the controversial group known as the White Helmets. Take a look.
Stabilization funding is under review at this time. We recognize and appreciate and are very grateful for all the work that the White Helmets continues to do on behalf of the people of their country and on behalf of the U.S. government and all the coalition forces. They're doing incredible work in rescuing, In some cases, in other cases, it's recovery efforts. They're an incredible group of individuals.
Now, the White Helmets claim to be a neutral entity in Syria. They say they're just helping people caught in the middle of a civil war. But are they? Follow the money, and you're going to find numerous ties to government funding from not only the U.S., but the U.K., the Netherlands, Denmark, and Germany. And here's the thing. Untangling these ties to the White Helmets, it gets pretty complicated. So stay with me. Here we go. According to their website, the Syria Civil Defense, nicknamed the White Helmets, actually formed in late 2012 to early 2013 as self-organized groups. Realizing they needed training, 20 Syrians went to Turkey back in March of 2013 to learn from a former British Army officer named James Lemessurier. Now, Lemessurier, he has ties to the failed NATO intervention in Kosovo. He developed a training program for Syrians. It included trauma care, command and control, and crisis management courses. He is specifically credited for helping form the White Helmet's structure and the White Helmet's operations. Lemessurier was able to fund the training for the program, though, through Mayday Rescue, his Netherlands-based nonprofit funded by grants from the Dutch, the British, the Danish, and the German governments. Now, this brings us to December of 2013, when the UK-based PR machine backing the White Helmets was first established. It's called the Voices Project, set up as a private limited company for public relations and communications activities. Part of the Voices Project's articles of incorporation state that the organization seeks to influence public opinion and influence governmental and other bodies and institutions regarding reform, legislation, and regulation. So who set up the Voices Project? Well, the first listed director on the Articles of Incorporation is Jeremy Hymans, the co-founder and the CEO of the global PR platform Purpose, and a co-founder of the controversial online activist network Avaaz. Though Hymans stepped down from his position with the Voices Project in 2015, his connection to the project is worth noting. And here's why. In February of 2014, New York-based Purpose listed a job posting for interns to help, quote, launch a new movement for Syria, end quote. By March of 2014, the Voices Project set up the Syria Campaign NGO, which they describe as a human rights organization that supports Syria's heroes in their struggle for freedom and democracy. Now, this coinciding with the graduates of the Mayday Rescue training establishing a new team in Syria. 6 months later, in October of 2014, a conference of these teams actually came together to establish the Syrian Civil Defense as an official national organization. They became known, as we know them today, as the White Helmets, thanks to the Syria campaign. According to their website, the White Helmets have been directly funded by Mayday Rescue and a company called Chemonix since 2014. Yet there's evidence that both of those organizations started supporting the White Helmets back in early 2013, right around the time that the White Helmets claim to have formed as self-organized groups. Mayday Rescue, as we said, is funded by the Dutch, the British, the Danish, and the German governments, and Chemonix. They're a Washington, D.C.-based contractor that was awarded $128.5 million in January of 2013 to support a peaceful transition to a democratic and stable Syria as part of USAID's Syria Regional Program. At least $32 million has been given directly to the White Helmets as of February of this year. The firm has been funded by USAID for years, and it carries a record of failures in supporting so-called humanitarian interventions, including, by the way, the one in Libya. So what you need to know here is that, first of all, this was only part one of our look at the White Helmets. There are even more dots to connect here, including the relationship between USAID, Chemonix, Jeremy Hyman, and Avaaz. We're going to make those connections in another episode of Reality Check. But for today, let's make this clear. There are very real questions about the authenticity of the voice of the White Helmets as representative of the Syrian people. It's also clear that the White Helmets have ties to organizations that are being funded by governments that have been and right now continue to seek to overthrow the Assad government and to establish a new regime in Syria. And yet our media and our government act as if the information coming from the White Helmets is actually coming from an impartial observer. It is not. In fact, it appears to actually be coming from an organization that is being funded with an agenda to see the Syrian government overthrown. That's Reality Check.
And now here's how one Syrian girl sees the situation. She calls herself Syrian Girl, and here she is.
Hi, everyone. This is Syrian Girl. Syria has been attacked by the U.S.-Israeli-French alliance. Missiles struck the T-4 military base, a base that is crucial to the fight against ISIS. This comes right after a false flag chemical attack in the suburb of Douma in Ghouta, Damascus. The neocons are blaming the Syrian government for the chemical attack. But once again, there is no motive because Assad was winning. After 7 years of war, Ghouta is almost completely liberated from Al-Qaeda-linked rebels. Thousands of civilians have evacuated the city. For years, the rebels weren't allowing them to leave because they were using them as human shields. Most rebel groups in Ghouta surrendered, but one rebel group called the Army of Islam, which controls Douma, refused. This is because they believed they had leverage in the form of civilian hostages that they kidnapped from a nearby pro-Assad Alawite town called Adra.
They were taken by Sunni rebels last August.
The Army of Islam, one of the groups the US listed as moderate, kidnapped men, women and children. They put them in cages and paraded them around the city of Douma, saying that if Assad bombs the rebels, the hostages would die. They were literally using them as human shields. A few weeks ago, they released footage of these hostages walking through an underground tunnel in Douma, injured and distressed. Since these civilians were from a pro-Assad Alawite town, the rebels thought that they had more value as human shields than the civilians of Douma. But the war continued, and it looked like the Army of Islam were about to surrender. But suddenly, they stalled negotiations and rained hundreds of missiles down on Damascus city center. You see, some of their members didn't want to surrender. This was when the false flag chemical attack happened. It's obvious the people, the children that were killed in the gas attack, were the hostages that the rebels had kidnapped. Footage of four children suffocated in an underground bunker emerged. A wood-burning oven right behind them was producing carbon monoxide. The rebels also released footage of perfectly healthy kids being drugged and hosed down. Some of the hostages have been rescued. Among them is Judy. She was abducted 4 years ago when she was only 8 months old. How many children just like her didn't make it and were gassed by the rebels in a false flag attack? And just look at the timing. A week prior to this attack, Trump said he would pull troops out of Syria. Now he's saying he's going to attack Assad. It's the exact repeat of last year's scenario. The chemical attack that occurred in Idlib on the 4th of April in 2017 occurred almost a year to the day of this attack. And a week prior to that attack, the US said regime change was no longer the objective in Syria. And afterwards, Trump attacked Syria. Also, a day prior to the chemical attack, Israeli President Netanyahu called Trump and told him that he wasn't allowed to pull out of Syria. It's obvious who benefits. It's not the US soldiers that recently died in North Syria. This chemical attack is the excuse that Israel and the neocons need to keep the US troops in Syria indefinitely and have a casus belli for World War III.
So you've heard today from several voices that you will rarely, if ever, hear in the corporate media and some so-called alternative media. You can decide where the truth lies when it comes to 9/11 and the 9/11 wars. But remember, they lied to us about Vietnam. They lied to us about Iraq having WMDs. They've lied to us about the JFK, MLK, and RFK assassinations. Do you really think they're telling us the truth about 9/11 or about the wars and now Syria? Do you really think we're getting the truth there from the corporate media and the government? And I would encourage you to look up Operation Mockingbird if you still think you're being told the truth by the corporate media. And get ready for more war, because Iran has just announced that it has banned the use of the U.S. dollar in all trade transactions, prohibiting businesses from registering import orders using the currency. This was announced on Wednesday of last week following an official request by the Central Bank of Iran. It's meant to address fluctuations in the dollar. But Western bankers want full-spectrum dominance economically, and we're probably not all that happy with Iran's decision to ban the dollar. So last week, Manhattan District Judge George Daniels made a default ruling, and a default ruling is one that is issued in the absence of a defendant, that found Tehran liable for the deaths and ordered its entities to pay over $6 billion in compensations to the families of more than 1,000 victims of the September 11th attacks. So now Iran is being blamed for the September 11th attacks. Of course, they provide no evidence about how they were involved. And I have to say, having studied 9/11 for 16 years now, I have seen no evidence linking 9/11 to Iran at all. But when you have an agenda like full spectrum dominance, and like what General Wesley Clark informed us about, the 7 countries in 5 years, evidence doesn't seem to matter. It certainly didn't concerning 9/11 either, even though there's a whole body of scientific evidence that proves that what the government and corporate media have told us about it can't possibly be true. So I'm going to end the show today with a song called 9/11's a Lie by the Freebies, and it's sung to the tune of Stayin' Alive. So here it is, 9/11's a Lie.
This is from the old school, new school. We are nothing away. We are.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Beyond the G7, the dollars and cents of globalization and trade, a view from the left. Lori Wallach, director, Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, whose books include The Rise and Fall of Fast Track Trade Authority, Whose Trade Organization, a comprehensive guide to the WTO. And recently, Wallach was one of three panelists alongside Chancellor Angela Merkel at the C20 summit titled Civil 20 Dialogue with the G20 Presidency, which addressed the most pressing globalization challenges of the 2017 G20 summit. Lori Wallach, it is an absolute pleasure to have you back with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I want to go back to 2016 to set the context for the rest of our discussion. And that was when we were looking at the issue of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and many of us were fighting mightily against that. And the issue of NAFTA was still very prevalent. Many folks were very antagonistic to it, as well they should be, particularly in the working class here. And the election, which some people feel catapulted Trump ahead by virtue of having a position that would seem to be counter to certainly the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership. Give us the kind of trajectory of issues and their real import for the working class on these issues since the 2016 election.
President Trump, as a candidate, promised a lot of very big changes, appropriating what had been a critique coming from labor unions and progressive groups like Public Citizen and largely Democrats in Congress, but some of what I would call the Main Street Republicans, the guys who actually stand with labor sometimes and stand with the small businesses, not the guys just flocking for the big multinationals. That critique and as well specific policy demands for changes in policies and trade agreements to change those outcomes, that whole agenda was largely appropriated by Trump. Bernie Sanders was running on a similar set of critiques and a slightly different than Trump set of solutions. Bernie's more internationalist and Trump's more nationalist. Ultimately, they boiled down to getting rid of the incentives now at the heart of trade agreements like NAFTA to outsource jobs, the rules that absent any floor of labor standards, wage standards, toxics rules, environmental standards, incentivize U.S. companies to relocate production to Mexico to pay very low wages and dump toxics and then bring the products back to the U.S. for sale. In addition, both Sanders, with a more internationalist view of it, and Trump, with a more nationalist view, had policies to try and deal with what I would call our second big set of trade problems. We have trade agreements that have been big job killers, and we have a trade policy with respect to China that has led to enormous trade deficits. And even by the supporters of the trade status quo, an admission of several million, perhaps up to 3 million U.S. manufacturing jobs lost. Under NAFTA, the U.S. government has certified almost 1 million industrial jobs lost. So the critique was there, and then what's happened since? Trump has flip-flopped on most of his China-related trade promises. He promised he would declare China a currency violator, a manipulator, and the first day in office and quickly get that trade balance in order. In fact, in Trump's first 18 months, the China trade deficit has steadily grown. Trade deficit for the first 4 months of 2018 is the highest on record for the first 4 months of any month. Not only did Trump not do anything about China and the currency issues, but he has been going all over the place, back and forth, on what his China trade policy will be. They did launch, about a month ago, a big trade enforcement case aimed at one prong of what, correctly, is part of the underlying problem with our China trade policies, which is we're kind of playing by these rules the corporations in the U.S. wrote that are kind of vaguely somewhat capitalistic slash managed trade. And the Chinese government is running a set of trade policies that are very much not with those rules, and are with the government basically heavily involved in sort of a strategic, both military and economic agenda that includes big subsidies and forced technology transfer from the U.S. and dumping of excess product and buying up U.S. companies that would be competitors in strategic sort of industries of the future, like robotics and other sectors, driverless cars, and then taking out the technology and getting rid of the domestic companies to get rid of the competition. It's pretty predatory behavior. And the administration launched an effort to do something about that. But then, 2 weeks later, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, he formerly of a big Wall Street firm, decided he was putting that on hold and that instead we'd just sell some more soy and airplanes and liquid natural gas to China and everything would be fine. People calm down. Don't go at the structural issues. And then a week after that, the president flip-flopped back. And in the middle of that, the president, seemingly for his own business interests, caved in on basically a deal to stop a Chinese company that was seen as a security risk, ZTE, the phone company. The phones were banned on U.S. military bases because they were seen as spying devices. Plus, the company was up for $1 billion in sanctions for selling phones to Iran and North Korea that could be used as spying devices. And the company was about to get shut down under these sanctions. And then the president dove in to save it. And then, you know, funny thing. $500 million loan went to a resort development in Indonesia where there were Trump properties that were struggling. So they're all over on China. The good news is NAFTA. Actually, they're heading in the right direction on replacing NAFTA. And we can talk more about the details, but here's a shocker. If you guys are holding up hot coffee, now's the time to put it down. The administration has insisted on eliminating investor-state dispute settlement, those outrageous corporate privileges that make it easier and safer to outsource jobs and that empower multinational corporations to attack our domestic laws in front of tribunals of three corporate attorneys who can order unlimited sums of taxpayer money if a foreign company, a multinational, thinks that a domestic law for the environment or a safety regulation or a court ruling undermines the new NAFTA privileges. Well, the Trump administration put down their foot and said that needs to come out. And they've been so firm about it that Mexico and Canada have basically agreed. And that was one of the core things in the TPP for all folks fighting across the country. These are those outrageous tribunals and investor rights. Mm. They first started in NAFTA. They were getting even beefier in the TPP. Well, this NAFTA renegotiation looks to take those out. Plus, there are a handful of other things that are exactly the things progressives have been demanding for decades that, coincidentally, you want to change the outcomes in NAFTA, you don't have anything else you can do. You got to change this stuff. So they're pushing some of the right stuff. And even on wages and labor standards, is not totally bleak to be discussed.
Laura, I definitely want to get back to NAFTA later on, but I want to talk about tariffs. When Trump first took over, the main concern was this case in Indiana on the ball bearing plant where the jobs were being outsourced. And that was talked about a lot in other outsourcing. But now it seems to be tariffs, 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 as we've seen at the recent G7s. Can you tell us your takeaway from what was happening at the G7 and what wasn't discussed at the G7, which was most of the issues that you talked about so far.
The G7 situation is one that I find extremely peculiar. most of the G7 leaders have worked to build warm relationships with Trump, despite his xenophobia, racism, misogyny, climate denialism, warmongering, and even corrupt business self-dealing. But that ended at this G7. He got welcomed like a rabid skunk to the picnic. Why? None of those previous sins was enough. No! The man took on the trade status quo, a bridge too far for the G7 leaders. Now, I'm being melodramatic about it, but it really annoys me. It's a bitter irony, because trade and financial policies that the G7 leaders have relentlessly promoted really created the political context that helped to make Trump president with all of the attending woe. There have been decades of U.S. presidents, Democrats and Republicans alike, and their G7 counterparts, who have pushed international economic policies that have created expansive new rights and powers for multinational companies and hurt working people, not just in the U.S., not just in Europe, but around the world. So the agenda G7 for decades has been pushing corporate rig trade agreements, blessing financial deregulation, and loosening trillions in speculative investment flows. Meanwhile, even as millions of manufacturing jobs were lost, most notably here but in other countries as well, there was no coordinated G7 action to counter China's currency manipulation. There was no unified approach to end the subsidies in China and other unfair practices that, among other things, led to the huge global steel and aluminum oversupply glut, which then loops us back to these damn tariffs. Because the tariffs are a tool that are supposed to try and fix this aluminum and steel oversupply. The tariffs are not supposed to be a permanent feature of the landscape. The tariffs were threatened, and a bunch of countries basically took one of six possible steps, the goal of which was to shut down markets for the subsidized oversupply of Chinese steel and aluminum. Brazil, Australia, Korea, different countries figured out either, hey, we're not sending you that stuff. We're not shipping it through our country to you. We're not buying that stuff. You don't have to worry about us. We get an exception. Or, all right, we are buying some of that stuff. So we agree to send you one-third less of it than we would otherwise. Or we are selling you that stuff, and we're going to continue to, so I guess we'll just have to take the tariffs on the aluminum. But on steel, totally kosher. We're not doing that. Other countries negotiated settlements. It's unclear to me, as a sort of recovering trade attorney, why Europe and Canada didn't negotiate a deal, or Mexico for that matter. All those parties thought they weren't ever going to get sanctioned, despite clearly being part of the issue. You know, no one claims Canada is a security threat. The statute under which this was done has to do with the potential security threat if the U.S. has no source of aluminum or steel that is reliable either for our domestic infrastructure or for military defense. So we are right now down to, they've all the rest have been run out of business, one aluminum plant that makes aircraft-grade aluminum. This was the study that was done before these tariffs were threatened, and then a lot of countries negotiated terms. But some countries didn't, and those are the tariffs. And the countries that got the tariffs are really upset about it, understandably. Some of them have counter-sanctioned, so it's called retaliation. And the question is, will the countries all keep their eyes on the goal, which is to counter this oversupply? They've been talking about this in different international fora for 4 years, haven't done anything. And the U.S. has absorbed the brunt of it, which has been okay with the other G7 countries as long as it wasn't landing in their laps. But now that we're putting up those tariffs, all that extra supply is going to start to float around other places, which probably is making the other countries as mad as the tariffs. The problem with all of this is that Trump himself is so nasty, disrespectful, vindictive, personal, that instead of being able to have a constructive discussion of, ladies and gentlemen of the G7, we have a mutual problem. We're getting flooded with Chinese aluminum and steel. We spent 4 years talking with you. Then we spent 4 months telling you we're going to put up sanctions if this didn't get fixed. Let us work together to fix the problem. That's the way to avoid. No, that's not the kind of discussion. Instead, it became very personal, and that's not constructive.
Lori, you have been dubbed the trade debate's guerrilla warrior in a National Journal profile and the Ralph Nader with a sense of humor in a Wall Street Journal profile. But you are making my head spin because I want to be grounded firmly and rooted against anything and everything that is part of Agent Orange, i.e. Donald Trump. But you are actually taking me in a direction that is very troubling to perhaps a very doctrinaire politic, and that is I must be dismissive of, or worse, defeat anything and everything that is Donald Trump. So how am I supposed to understand these things? Are we talking about protectionism? Are we talking about isolationism? What do we really mean about trade wars? And are you taking me in the direction of saying that but for the bitterness and the egomaniacal personality and behavior of Trump, that these policies are actually advantageous to the working class? Oh, help me out on this one. I'm looking for guidance.
It's head spinning. I pulled out Alice in Wonderland just to try and get a sense of Alice going down the rabbit hole to get some perspective. The reality is that in trade politics, it's not so much left and right. You have Democrats and Republicans who have a view of what trade and globalization policy should be, and most of it's actually not even about trade. Most of it's new investor rights and the investor state tribunals and deregulating finance. It has nothing to do with actual trade. There's a view that Republicans and Democrats of that corporate view have basically identical views of how it should go. And then there is a view that is from the left, a worker-centered, people and planet-centered view. And from the right is a sort of small business and national interest, nationalistic, what's good for the nation, the United States view. And there is probably about a 70% overlap in what the policy changes and concerns are with the people who do not take the corporatist view on trade. It does not matter if you are a super conservative or you are a super lefty. For different reasons, you don't like investor state dispute settlement. I mean, Chief Justice Roberts of the Supreme Court laid out the threat it poses to our sovereignty. The National Conference of State Legislatures, dominated by Republicans, has taken a position of opposing any trade agreement that has investor state dispute settlement. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Professor Stiglitz, Professor Tribe, icons of progressive thinking, have also said they'll oppose any trade agreement that has ISDS. It's a democracy issue. It's a corporate power issue. But in either instance, if you want to be as kind as possible, it boils down to undermining people's power and democracy in favor of these extra judicial bodies. When it comes, for instance, to one of the issues where you would not expect any official of the Trump administration to do the right thing, but the chief trade negotiator is a guy who has worked with unions, worked in the steel manufacturing sector for years. He is advocating for labor and environmental standards for NAFTA. We'll see if they end up getting the kind of standards that can get the support, say, of the unions. It's not done yet. They're actually fighting for improved standards, certainly relative to TPP, an agreement negotiated, yes, by a Democrat. This is where you see that line where it's not really Democrats versus Republicans. It is corporatist versus not. From the conservative perspective, low wages in Mexico, the dumping of toxics there is seen as what they call social dumping, basically externalizing costs of production. It's a subsidy promoting companies to go to Mexico for all the wrong reasons, not because there's some natural advantage, not because there's some particular reason, but rather because you can externalize costs that should be on the company. From a progressive perspective, obviously, labor rights and environmental rights are basic human rights. We believe as a matter of principle that there is a universal right to have a healthy environment. We need to keep our planet alive and well and combat climate chaos. We believe labor rights are universal rights. Doesn't really matter where you're coming to it. If you demand on having environmental and labor rights in a trade agreement and condition the terms of the agreement on it, that is a good development. There are a bunch of issues. NAFTA has a ban on buy local and buy American and buy New York, where you can't have local preferences to allow our tax dollars to get recycled into our economies. So from a progressive perspective, that's a problem with buy local. And that's a problem about building local economies. And that's a problem about having long distance shipping and what it does to the climate and not allowing communities to set preferences for the kind of, do they want sweat-free purchases, do they want a living wage? We see that from that perspective. From a more conservative perspective, they think of the Buy America laws from since the Great Depression as building a strong military-industrial base that is part of the strength of the country. There are a variety of issues that are at the core of changing NAFTA, where there is a peculiar left-right consensus. That is different and has been there all along, separate from Trump. The reason why the fact that Trump has any common position from where all of us have been, we've all been against NAFTA since before there was NAFTA. We could foresee what would happen. Trump was against NAFTA from way back when. His vision of what to do about it has that overlap, but then it goes very wrong. He then conflates the real issues, like the corporate outsourcing protections, with bashing Mexicans, being anti-Mexico. We see the fact that the agreement was written by elites in all three countries. In the U.S., there were 600 official corporate advisors who got to help write NAFTA, just like TPP. It's the same system. And we saw in Mexico, in Canada, the companies calling the shots. I mean, the campesinos, the small farmers in the southern part of Mexico were just destroyed by NAFTA. This was not in their interest. Real wages in Mexico now are lower than before NAFTA. No labor rights, no protections for workers, the elite basically having a system to cap independent unions. That's what you get. As we think about this moment, it is really too bad it is not President Sanders and a U.S. trade representative for one of the labor unions, because they would probably have that same 70% of the NAFTA fix. The other 30% would be very different, very internationalist, very progressive. For instance, Trump is pushing for new monopoly patent rights for big pharmaceutical companies in NAFTA that could raise medicine prices, versus if you had a really progressive Democrat, you would probably have some system of universal health care in the trade agreement. With respect to China, you might have a President Sanders using these same tariff tools. Tariff's just a tool if you use it strategically. If you bonk someone upside the head with it, with no demand, with no vision, with no goal, then a tariff becomes a weapon and you can get into a war. A tariff otherwise is a tool. Actually, it's very cynical. The mainstream media doesn't cover a lot of so-called trade wars and tariffs. Oh, my God. When they're threatened regularly against countries for not following corporate patent rights. We threaten tariffs, the U.S. does all the time. It's bad because countries are making generic versions of medicines and big pharma's upset. Don't see hysterical coverage about that. The hysteria about the tariffs now is because they're being threatened to try and save working class jobs. And that apparently deserves less favorable coverage.
Lori, it seems as if everybody's thinking of countries against countries. Can you also look at it as multinational corporations against workers of the world?
In the context of NAFTA, that's what I was describing. That's a difference between us and Trump. Trump looks at it nationalistically. The U.S. is getting ripped off. And we look at it and say, no. These corporate elite in the three countries got together and they wrote their playbook. And we've all gotten stuffed. Canada has paid over $200 million in the investor state sanctions, Canadian taxpayers, to foreign corporations. The U.S. has lost 1 million manufacturing jobs, and real wages are flat. Mexico has seen 2 million campesino farmers thrown off their land, and wages are down in their industrial sector. This has not been a win for working people in any three of the countries, and the kind of fixes that, strange though it seems, are actually being pushed right now. And you can get involved. Go to Public Citizen's Lefty Campaign on the Issue, www.replacenafta, one word, replacenafta.org, www.replacenafta.org. It tells you what you can do and also the state of negotiations where taking out the investor state dispute settlement rights is really happening and getting rid of the Buy America ban, maybe adding labor standards. That's the part we still need to fight on. Wage standards are being discussed. But also, when it comes to China, That is the one thing that is different. Generally, it is true. It is corporations against workers of the world. Certainly, the way the WTO played out has been that way. But with respect to China, when you have a government that is the private sector, that is the corporate sector, that is the military, that is the government, all rolled into one, and there's centralized planning of that government with respect to how, for instance, the China 2025 industrial strategy to dominate industries of the future relates to various military ambitions, relates to various territorial fights, to various diplomatic goals. It is a unified state power through trade and industry that is really distinct from any of our other trade partners, and so it's a different set of problems.
What is a view from the left? How do we situate ourselves, encapsulate all of this for us?
We need to, in this horrific Trump administration, see if we can jiu-jitsu out any single one piece of progress. And it may be that replacing NAFTA is that. There is an opportunity, improbable though it is, for a variety of peculiar political reasons to get a NAFTA replacement. It ain't done, but the odds are certainly better of winning on this than they were when we started the TPP fight and we all won that together.
Mm-hmm.
There is an opportunity to get a NAFTA replacement that sets the model of a different kind of trade agreement, the demands we've all been pushing for decades. It seems improbable. Go to www.replacenafta.org to hear more of the details. If we do the work right, the kind of agreement that we could get without ISDS would send a signal to the whole rest of the world that even here in the belly of the beast, we have actually taken a turn on these trade rules. And if that's the only good thing that happens, which is a NAFTA without investor-state dispute settlement, with labor standards, with some wage standards, without the ban on buy local, buy America, another thing that's being discussed is what's called a sunset clause. The agreement would terminate every 5 years unless we authorize, so it would inject some accountability and democracy. If we were able to achieve that almost by accident, for a variety of peculiar circumstances, that may be the only thing that is not just downright dreadful that happens in this administration. And it's only going to be good if we all fight to actually get the outcome we want.
And we're going to leave it there, but only for this moment, because all of us are going to continue to follow Lori Wallach's words and actions and policies. She is the director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, and you need to keep an eye on Global Trade Watch from Public Citizen to get the real skinny on all of these issues. Thank you for parsing out for us these enormously complex issues and giving us some of the nuances. And maybe I'll feel a little bit better because politics should be nuanced. Guess I have to be a little bit less doctrinaire. Lori.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. And let me just say, it is Pepto-Bismol swigging inducing to have to think about Trump associated with any of this stuff. We all just need to think about what have been our demands over the last number of decades, and let's see if we can win any of them. Let's not think about the circumstances of how, once we are able to fix these problems in the trade agenda, we have to face all the other horrific damage that we're not able to deal with this administration.
Lori Wallach, thank you for your wise comments, and we will make that so.
Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
The decision is deeply disappointing for our clients, Dave and Charlie, as well as Charlie's mother, Debbie, who was with them there that day and hoped to help her son select his wedding cake. But let's be clear, this was not the win the bakery had asked for, or the Trump administration, which had backed the bakery in the case.
They say, look, it's true that clergy have a constitutional right, based on free exercise of religion, to make distinctions among people's marriages. They can say, we're going to marry you and we're not going to marry you. But businesses do not have the right to put signs in their window that say, no Muslims, no gay people, etc.
To This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine, I'm Lucia Chappell. Bermuda rebounds for marriage equality, Scotland's parliament pardons anti-gay sex law convicts, and what's really baked into the U.S. Supreme Court's wedding cake ruling. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending June 9th, 2018. We reported in last week's NewsWrap on the law in Bermuda taking effect that replaced marriage equality with domestic partnerships. So naturally, 2 days after that newscast was distributed, the same court that had ruled for marriage equality in May 2017 overturned the domestic partnership replacement law and restored marriage equality to the island nation. Supreme Court Chief Justice Ian Kawali announced the ruling on June 6th, saying that the sections of the measure that revoked the right of same-gender couples to marry violated the British Overseas Territories Constitution, which guarantees the right to freedom of conscience and creed. The public gallery erupted in wild applause as the decision was being announced. Kawali wrote that persons who passionately believe that same-sex marriages should not take place for religious or cultural reasons are entitled to have those beliefs respected and protected by law, but in return for the law protecting their own beliefs, he said, they cannot require the law to deprive persons who believe in same-sex marriage of respect and legal protection for their opposing beliefs. Because the court said nothing about the domestic partnership provisions of the law, the ruling now gives same-gender couples the option of marriage or domestic partnerships.
However, the court stayed its ruling for 6 weeks to allow the government to appeal, as it's expected to do. Veteran gay journalist Rex Walkner says that such a challenge would be heard by the Court of Appeal, which meets only 4 times a year and is composed of 3 foreign judges. After that, one final appeal could be filed with the UK Privy Council. Cruise ship giant Carnival was forced to scuttle weddings at sea for same-gender couples that it had been promoting when lawmakers revoked marriage equality late last year. The company, whose subsidiaries include Cunard, Princess, and P&O Cruises, operates 24 vessels flying the Bermuda flag, primarily for financial reasons. It partially funded the successful challenge to the law that replaced marriage equality with domestic partnerships. And a statement issued soon after the law was overturned said the company looks forward to resuming its romantic weddings at sea for gay and lesbian couples, adding that, "We believe it is important to oppose any actions that restrict travel and tourism."
The European Union's Court of Justice issued a groundbreaking ruling this week that guarantees freedom of movement by married same-gender couples in all EU member states, whether or not a member state has itself opened civil marriage to queer couples. One of those countries without marriage equality is Romania. Adrian Coman sought recognition in his homeland of his legal Belgian marriage in 2010 to American Clay Hamilton. Without it, the couple can't settle in Romania as they'd like. It would be virtually automatic if they were a heterosexual couple. Coman appealed his case to EU justices after being rejected by Romanian courts. Although the member states have the freedom whether or not to authorize marriage between persons of the same sex, the Court of Justice of the European Union concluded in its June 5th decision, they may not obstruct the freedom of residence of an EU citizen by refusing to grant his same-sex spouse, a national of a country that is not an EU member state, a derived right of residence in their territory. In a media statement, Coman said that it is human dignity that wins today. The ruling confirms a January recommendation by the court's advocate general. While those decisions are non-binding, justices usually endorse them.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled this week that anti-religious bias by the Colorado Civil Rights Commission against devout Denver-area Christian baker Jack Phillips was enough to hand a narrow victory to him for refusing to make a wedding cake for a gay couple, Charlie Craig and David Mullins. While mainstream news coverage of the decision suggested that it was a major victory for so-called religious liberty, most legal eagles believe it was not. Many think that the ruling actually affirmed the right of LGBT people to not be discriminated against. We'll have comprehensive coverage and analysis immediately after this newscast on most of these This Way Out stations.
In other news, a unanimous vote in the Scottish Parliament on June 6th approved a measure to pardon gay and bisexual men who were convicted under since-repealed anti-gay sex laws. The Scotsman newspaper reported that the Police Service of Scotland counted almost 1,000 people who will be eligible for the pardons. Gay sex was outlawed in Scotland until 1980, when it was legalized for men over the age of 21. The age of consent for gay men was lowered to 16 in 2001, the same age of consent for heterosexual couples. When the bill was initially published in November of last year, First Minister Nicola Sturgeon issued a public apology to the men who were convicted under those laws.
Religious bodies in two countries have taken divergent paths in their treatment of legally married same-gender couples. Members of the General Synod of the Anglican Episcopal Church of Brazil voted 57-3 this week to approve church weddings of lesbian and gay couples. Brazil opened the civil institution to those couples in 2012. Outgoing primate Bishop Francisco de Assis da Silva told the Anglican Communion News Service that this widens our boundaries, allowing us to be more welcoming to the diversity of people in our country. The move is likely to add fuel to the fire that's already burning within the global denomination, pitting more progressive branches like the Canadian Anglican Church, the Episcopal Church in the U.S., and now Brazilian Anglicans against conservative traditionalists in what's known as the Global South, Africa, most of Latin America, and Asia, who believe that the Bible condemns same-gender love.
Meanwhile, the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland voted on June 8th to ban membership by same-gender couples and to deny baptism to their children. According to Pink News, documents of the harsh new policy adopted by the largest of the Presbyterian denominations in Ireland claim that, in light of our understanding of Scripture, it is clear that same-sex couples are not eligible for communicant membership, nor are they qualified to receive baptism for their children. We believe that their outward conduct and lifestyle is at variance with a life of obedience to Christ. And to add insult to injury, the Assembly also voted to cut ties with the Church of Scotland, which has relaxed its policies on blessing civilly married gay and lesbian couples.
But Guyana hosted its first ever LGBT Pride Parade on June 2nd. Marchers in the small South American nation focused on broken election campaign promises by both major parties to outlaw discrimination against vulnerable groups, including LGBTQ people. Happily, there were no confrontations between activists and opponents, as some had feared. One local outlet reported that several curious onlookers turned out at the starting point and along the route to get a glimpse of the parade by people of all walks of life, races, and ages. Activist Joel Simpson praised the police for ensuring a peaceful march. "They served and protected us tonight," he said. At the post-parade rally, Simpson criticized several conservative Christian pastors in Georgetown who had called on the government to ban what they called an illegal march. Aren't we all entitled to freedom of assembly, freedom of association, freedom of expression, equal protection of the law, and every right under the Constitution? I don't know what they are talking about, he said. Several marchers carried placards with messages like, walking with pride and love, LGBT rights are human rights, and be who you are, not who the world wants you to be.
And finally, it was once thought that mincing his words was a telltale sign that a man was gay. Well, an out-and-proud candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor in the U.S. state of Maryland isn't mincing his words in a new political ad. In fact, you should be able to hear the coup de grace during the last shot in the ad of the candidate with his husband of 16 years and their two adorable children of color.
I'm Rich Madalino. I'm running for governor to deliver progressive results and to stand up to Donald Trump. Here are a few of the things I've done that already infuriate him. I protected Planned Parenthood from the Republicans in Congress.
Take that, Trump.
I helped ban assault weapons in Maryland.
Take that, NRA.
I believe in public schools, not vouchers.
Take that, Trump.
And Betsy DeVos.
Yeah!
And what's the number one way I piss off Donald Trump and the Republicans? Take that, Trump.
His campaign manager, Keith Pressley, said that they made sure to include Fox and Friends, a show known to be a particular favorite of Mr. Trump, when they bought time for the ad on local cable and TV shows. Pressley told USA Today that, "We wanted to make sure the president had an opportunity to see this ad."
It's a little bit sad.
That's News Wrap, Global Queer News with Attitude, for the week ending June 2nd, 2018, written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the all-new thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
I'm a little tired of the weary throwaway line that there is no such thing as the gay sensibility. Of course there is such a thing as the gay sensibility. Of course gay men and women think in some fundamental ways differently from straights. It is not just about what we do in bed. It is about the echoes in the culture of who we are or who we aren't. Hi, I'm Clive Barker. Listen to This Way Out.
If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a cake, baked a cake, baked a cake. If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a cake. Well, how'd you do, how'd you do, how'd you do?
The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled in favor of a Colorado baker who refused to make a wedding cake for a gay couple. But here's what much of the mainstream media coverage got wrong. The June 4th decision was not definitive on the broader issue of religious-based discrimination in the marketplace. Instead, the court zeroed in on the point that in this particular case, the Colorado Civil Rights Commission had been openly antagonistic toward religion in its ruling against the baker. Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote in the High Court's decision that future cases would need to be determined with tolerance, without undue respect to sincere religious beliefs, and without subjecting gay persons to indignities when they seek goods and services in an open market. You may not have gotten those fine points if you only heard reports like this.
The Denver-based baker, Jack Phillips, had argued that his rights of religious freedom and free speech meant that he shouldn't have to make a cake for a ceremony he finds offensive to his faith, which is why he refused to make a wedding cake for a gay couple who came into his shop in 2012. That couple took the case to the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, which ruled that the public accommodations law requires businesses to serve customers equally and cannot discriminate according to sexual orientation. The U.S. Supreme Court ruling is seen as a victory for the Christian religious right in the U.S. and as a blow to civil rights and gay rights advocates. In Denver, I'm Mary McCarthy.
Out San Francisco politician Mark Leno told Pacifica Evening News that he and many other equality advocates are concerned that the general public is receiving a misleading account of the ruling.
We cannot dictate to religious organizations. Government cannot do that because of the First Amendment protection to freedom of religion. But that doesn't mean businesses that serve the public have the right to discriminate. But this Supreme Court sent a message, whether it was a narrowly defined decision today or not, there's great risk and danger that this country will understand this differently.
It's a huge public relations win for the right wing because this has been reported all over as a win for the baker, a win for religious actions.
So, is it a precedent or a paint job? Our friends Ann Northrup and Andy Hum discussed the high court ruling at length on their Gay USA TV show this week with James Essex, director of the ACLU LGBT and AIDS Project.
Monday was a difficult day for us at the ACLU, but also obviously for the clients, that Dave Mullins and Charlie Craig, the two guys who are at the center of this, and they bear the brunt of what the court thinks of as anti-religion hostility by the Civil Rights Commission. Dave and Charlie had nothing to do with that, and it's really unfortunate and I think a travesty that they bear the burden.
So what do you think of the news coverage?
The problem is that, headlines are short, and the reality is that this was a loss for us. The baker wins.
The baker is Jack Phillips.
And Charlie and Dave lose. But I think that there is an awful lot in this decision that is actually very good for LGBT people going forward. And I think the core point is our opponents, Alliance Defending Freedom and anti-LGBT advocates like them, have been pushing a campaign for a long time to use religious exemptions as a way to undermine LGBT equality. And this was their effort to get a ruling that said that the Constitution requires discrimination, that the Constitution gives them a license to discriminate based on their religious beliefs or based on their artistic freedom. And that is precisely what they did not get in this opinion.
Yeah, I mean, you say the baker won, but he didn't win. He did not win the right to discriminate on the basis of religion.
Absolutely.
All he won was a technical decision that the Human Rights Commissioner had spoken disparagingly of his religious beliefs, and therefore he doesn't have to sell the cake. But that's not an overall right.
Yes, exactly. What the bakery and Alliance Defending Freedom get out of this is a ruling that says, well, when and if a government agency that's an adjudicator of legal claims, like the Civil Rights Commission or a court, acts in a way that is anti-religion, that violates the Constitution. But that's all they got, and it's not what they were looking for.
Obviously, the decision is deeply disappointing for our clients, Dave and Charlie, as well as Charlie's mother, Debbie, who was with them there that day and hoped to help her son select his wedding cake. And, of course, the experience ended up being very different.
Rhea Marr is a senior staff attorney with the ACLU and the counsel of record for the couple in Masterpiece Cake Shop v. Colorado Civil Rights Commission. She echoed some of her ACLU colleagues James Essex's analysis during her appearance this week on Democracy Now!
Let's be clear. This was not the win the bakery had asked for, or the Trump administration, which had backed the bakery in the case. You know, the court reversed based on peculiar facts in the history of the Civil Rights Commission's handling of this case. Those facts aren't likely to be repeated anytime soon. And in the process, the court recognized that Colorado can and should act to prevent the harms of discrimination in the marketplace, including when it comes to LGBT people.
Essex underscored the importance of the LGBTQ rights-affirming language in the decision.
The opinion is full of language from six justices on this court that is very affirming of stuff that we all agree on, but now is in the Supreme Court decision. What are those things? It says that the state has the power to pass civil rights laws that bar discrimination against people in Colorado, including LGBT people. It talks about the harm of discrimination as a real thing. Look, that shouldn't be a big deal, but in this context, it is. And most importantly, they recognize, they say, look, it's true that clergy, ministers, have a constitutional right, based on free exercise of religion, to make distinctions among people's marriages. They can say, we're going to marry you and we're not going to marry you. That's part of their faith. They get to do that. The government can't tell them they have to do something different. That, of course, is no one was ever arguing anything different. But the decision says that, of course, we can't go that right that clergy has, that can't be extended to businesses and to be extended broadly, because we would end up in a situation where many, many businesses might be turning, for example, same-sex couples away, and that would cause incredible stigma. And it also says, look, that would lead to a situation where businesses would be free to put signs up in their windows that say, for example, wedding cakes for heterosexuals only. And it's clear that Justice Kennedy doesn't think that's okay. And it's not just Justice Kennedy, but six justices sign on to that language. Businesses do not have the right to put signs in their window that say, no Muslims, no gay people, etc.
In 2015, a Washburn, Tennessee Baptist minister actually posted a No Gays Allowed sign in the window of his hardware store in response to the Supreme Court ruling on marriage equality, but he was pressured to remove it. What just happened as a result of the misleading headlines about the new ruling? It's back. On the other hand, an Arizona State Appeals Court cited this week's ruling to find against a Christian-owned Phoenix area calligraphy company. The company claimed that requiring them to make wedding invitations for same-gender couples was a violation of their freedom of religion. San Francisco supervisor Jeff Sheehy worried about a false dichotomy at play.
One of the things I find really offensive about it is underlying all of this is an assumption that LGBT folk are not people of faith. We are Catholic. We are Jewish. We are Episcopalian. We are Methodist. We are Baptist. We also are people of faith. And somehow to set religion on one side and the LGBT community on the other is completely sinister in my view.
Then what of the cake maker? Would his rights to freedom of speech and freedom of expression be denied if he were forced to bake Dave and Charlie's wedding cake, as his attorneys argued before the high court? The ACLU's James Essex untangled that constitutional knot.
Yes, there are products that businesses produce and sell that are creative, that are expressive. And I'm happy to say that you admit that cakes can be in that category. But the legal question that the court should be engaging with, and this is the doctrine that they have applied in many other contexts, even though they didn't really apply it here, is something that says, look, the question isn't how expressive is this product. The question is, when the state legislature passed the civil rights law in Colorado, were they aiming at speech, or were they aiming at religion, or were they aiming at conduct? If they were aiming at speech or religion, that's a big problem. Government is not supposed to be aiming at stifling people's speech and expression or stifling, restricting people's religious beliefs. But if they're aiming at conduct, that is the conduct of selling goods and services in the commercial marketplace by businesses open to the public, that is perfectly constitutional, even if some of the businesses are engaged in activities that are expressive. The court has said again and again, if the state legislature, the law is not aimed at speech or aimed at religion, even if it has incidental effects on expressive activity, it is constitutional.
The ACLU's Ria Maher also noted that the court did seem to recognize the need for discrimination protections for LGBT people.
It's worth noting that argument, if accepted, would not have been limited to discrimination against LGBT people and could have implicated many of the other characteristics protected under Colorado law, including race, religion, and disability. And the court didn't go that far. It had concerns about the way the Civil Rights Commission had handled this particular case. But in the process of doing that, it repeatedly underscored the significance of laws like Colorado's Anti-Discrimination Act, which have a long and storied history, dating in this case to 1885, the Reconstruction era. So you see the majority really understood the significance of laws like these to our ability to participate freely in the marketplace. And the court today said the same is true when it comes to people who are LGBT.
Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg were the only two dissenters from the majority ruling written by Justice Anthony Kennedy. And Kennedy has written virtually every queer positive U.S. Supreme Court decision since 2003. Gay USA's Andy Hum asked the ACLU's James Essex about the vote.
This was a 7-2 decision. I mean, some people might want to say, well, that makes it a good decision.
I don't know that it makes it good or bad. I think that what's going on here is we will never see, or history will tell, when the various justices' papers are released in 50 years or whenever it is that happens, maybe we'll learn more about what the horse trading was. What did they get? But look, it's a common thing in courts whether it's three-judge courts at the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court or other state courts, you have multiple justices, and they go back and forth. I'll sign if you change this. I'll sign you if you add that. That is, people are wondering, well, how in the world could Kagan and Breyer sign on to this thing? That is what was going on there, and that's a normal thing, and that's part of how we get protected.
Andy Hum got Essex to peer into the judicial crystal ball.
We're most concerned about where the court's going to go in the future, and there are other cases we're concerned about. Most prominently, the cases that say discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation is sex discrimination. Transgender is sex discrimination. Yes. That's going to be the big enchilada, is it not?
It may well be. I think there's a decent chance that the court is going to take one or more of the cases that raise this sex discrimination question. Do the bans on sex discrimination in federal civil rights law, do they cover lesbian, gay, bisexual people? There are two petitions pending right now. They won't be decided until the fall on that question. And then there's a petition coming in August. With the same question about do the bans on sex discrimination cover transgender people.
Do you want the court? I mean, of course, it's going to be decided by the makeup of the court, but do you want the court to decide this?
Well, that's a difficult question. There are now five or six federal appeals courts, different circuits, regional, geographically defined regional courts in the federal system that agree that trans people are covered. In lots of different contexts, in education and in unemployment, et cetera.
Yeah.
And now there are two federal appeals courts, federal circuits, that agree that lesbian, gay, and bisexual people are. You know, one track is to just build that out so that when the Supreme Court ultimately gets the question, most of the courts are already on board. So the difficult question is, do you pull the trigger and ask for the Supreme Court to decide that right now? Two of those three petitions are by employers that don't like the fact that federal appeals courts have said that LGBT people are covered. And we don't have any control over that they have asked for it. One of the petitions is by an employee in Atlanta who was told, oh, you can't bring that claim by the courts, and is saying to the Supreme Court, hey, you know, that's not fair.
While we're waiting for the law to catch up with the world, what are we doing and not doing now?
In the wake of this decision, two things happened. One, we didn't take to the streets over this decision. I mean, I'm not happy with it, but I mean, but we didn't take to the streets. But also, the other thing that happened is a wave of people across the country are saying, you know, we are open. Our business is open to all. Open to all is the hashtag.
Yeah, open to all is the hashtag. People should go look at it. It is a truly amazing coalition of organizations. It's not just LGBT people. It's every civil rights movement that there is, all getting together.
So the culture has changed in that way, and will the law keep up with it?
Yeah.
We hope this analysis of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the case of Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission has brought you a better understanding of what it was and was not. As always, stay tuned for further developments as they happen on This Way Out. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from John Dyer V and Michelle Yeader, with thanks to Brian DeShazer, and from the Pacifica Evening News, Democracy Now!, and Andy Hum and Ann Northrup of Gay USA TV. The Fontaine Sisters and Elvis Presley performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, who make this program possible. Help keep our 30-year streak going at the all-new thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on Free Radio Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz, California, CHMA Sackville, New Brunswick, 2BOB Turin, New South Wales, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And with a hearty welcome to our newest listeners at WELT in Fort Wayne, Indiana, we say, stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What do food and agriculture have to do with political economy? What do food systems and agricultural arrangements and land fertility and the treatment of people who work the land, what do these things have to do with economic regimes and political ideologies and the development and dynamics of capitalism? In the eyes of Eric Holt Jimenez, our current corporate food regime must be replaced with an equitable and resilient system. And that, he says, requires changing everything. And that requires an understanding of the structures of neoliberal capitalism that dictate what we grow, what we eat, and what's happening to rural land and rural populations. Eric Holt Jimenez directs the Institute for Food and Development Policy, known as Food First, and for more than two decades he worked with peasant movements in Mexico and Central America. He's authored and edited a number of books, and his new book is A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. When Eric Holt Jimenez joined me recently in studio, I asked him what he was hoping to do with this book.
What I wanted to do with this book is really start with some political economic literacy for the food movement. I think that the food movement writ large has gotten to a place where it's starting to have a political impact and can begin thinking about political strategy. In the United States especially, I think we're really crippled by a lack of concepts and terminology that allows us to engage forcefully politically. And so this book is about political economy, and it's, you know, using the C word out loud because we have to. We desperately need to. We need to realize this is a capitalist food system. It's going to act the way capitalism acts. And if we want to change a capitalist food system, then we better understand capitalism. So that's what the book is for.
In chapter one, you describe the three global food regimes that have emerged historically. And it begins, this first chapter, with the role of agriculture in capitalist development and with the so-called enclosures that occurred in the British Isles. When and how did enclosures happen?
So if you go back to the 16th century, we begin to see the emergence of industry. And industry needs raw materials. In this case, the industry needed wool for the spinning looms in the cities that were being built. And they had a lot of difficulty getting enough supply because the peasantry was growing food. And yeah, they had some sheep out there, but they basically, you know, carded and spun their own stuff and sold a little bit on the market. And not enough for this industrial leap. So what happened was that the large landed gentry saw an opportunity. They basically shoved the peasantry off the land in order to put sheep on it. And the way they did that was first to enclose the commons. That's what we call them, the enclosures. And by enclosing the commons, privatizing the commons, something which goes on still today, peasants no longer had access to fuel and fodder and medicinal plants and couldn't graze their animals on the commons anymore. So, and this was an important part of peasant economy and village life. So they then had to work for wages. The other thing that happened was they got taxed. And so having to come up with money and not being able to rely on their full economy, they were forced to go to the cities to work. And they were also forced to then work on the larger, what became at that time, something close to plantations.
So there was a kind of consolidation of land ownership at the time?
Tremendous consolidation of land ownership. And this really characterizes capitalism. This is what Marx calls primitive accumulation, or original accumulation, some people call it. But it's that where you basically, the bourgeoisie, or the industrial class, or whomever it happens to be, could be a mercantile class as well, steals, appropriates, expropriates, and dispossesses people and villages and communities of their wealth. And in this case, the wealth was in the land, and so that's what they took, and that's what they needed. And so tremendous consolidation took place, which then creates this huge reserve army of labor. What's important to understand is that people resisted. They resisted for centuries. And so this was not a quick process, and it wasn't seamless by any means. It was actually very violent and bloody, and many people died, starved, and withered, certainly, in what were called the satanic mills in the industrial areas of jolly old England.
In the mid-19th century, British tariffs on imported grain were removed, opening the British Isles to imported grain. Was this the end of, or was this end of, British self-sufficiency in food production? Was this seen by elites as a problem?
Well, it depends on which elites. So if we're talking about the landed gentry, yes, this is a problem because suddenly the grains and the wool and, you know, the things which they are producing for the market with the help of peasant labor are being undercut by, you know, grain from the Ukraine, for example. And so they're very much against this. But the British industrialists are very much in favor because this cheapens the food basket. And they can then pay the workers relatively less because food is less expensive. So, you know, there was a struggle, an interclass struggle between the gentry and the bourgeoisie, and the bourgeoisie won.
And the bourgeoisie won, and one thing that certainly helped the situation of food in the British Isles was the fact that Britain was going elsewhere for raw materials and fertile lands and crops, right?
Absolutely. You know, dual processes were going on. On one hand, British high farming was being developed, and high farming was simply a form of farming for the gentry, which relied on peasant labor, but also relied very much on guano, which is nitrate-rich bird droppings. which they had to import. So this was like the first green revolution, really. Rather than using chemical fertilizers, they were using guano. So on one hand, Britain is specializing in its agricultural sector on the island, and not necessarily to feed Britain, but also for export. On the other hand, the British Empire is expanding and conquering and exploiting and extracting all around the world. And so we have what's called the dawn of the first colonial food regime, which is, you think about a food regime as all of the institutions and all of the rules which govern food production and consumption. Now, it doesn't have to be complete. In other words, not everybody in the world has to do this the same way, but it does have to be hegemonic. And certainly the British Empire's food regime was hegemonic, as were some of the other colonial powers. And so what we get then is that the industrial North is able to industrialize in part because they've dispossessed and exploited the peasantry on their own soil, but also because they dispossess and exploit the peasantry in foreign countries, which become their colonies. So the global South, or what becomes the Third World, the colonies of Africa, Asia, and certainly Latin America, ship cheap raw materials and food to the North. And this is a huge subsidy to the North, allowing it to industrialize. And that's really what characterizes the global food regime. It was the time of the most overt acts of genocide and expansion, and the bloodiest forms of primitive accumulation.
Yeah, and you're right about how crops like maize and potatoes and rice and sugar and tea, how important they were to early European capitalism. Rice, by the way, from Africa, plays an important role in cultivation in the, quote, New World. And slavery was, of course, a big part of that. You're right that prior to slavery, capitalist agriculture failed to keep up with the growing demand for cotton because capitalists could not force the peasantry to grow it on an industrial scale. How did slavery change that picture?
Yeah, this is a common challenge for capitalism, is to get enough raw materials and to extract enough of this material wealth from the countryside when the countryside is held either by peasants or indigenous people. And they just can't get them to produce enough. And so then they have to conquer. You know, all of the cultivars which you mentioned became commodities traded on global markets. And they all have a very sordid story behind them. Rice is especially heartbreaking because rice was grown by Africans who were experts at tidal irrigation, and they were also very good at milling the rice, which is a hard thing to do manually. And the Africans who were enslaved and put to work in the colonies had this knowledge. So rice, the knowledge of how to cultivate rice, comes over with Africans. And they did. And in the beginning, those who knew how to grow rice had to teach their masters how to do it. And they did this on the basis of exchange. There's very strong evidence to suggest that early African farmers who had been enslaved negotiated for plots of land, negotiated for better treatment in exchange for growing rice. Unfortunately, when the masters learned how to grow the rice, that was all reversed. So that's a sort of a tragic story of what is, an endogenous crop actually from Africa. We think all rice comes from Asia. It doesn't. This rice almost certainly all came from Africa.
Eric Holt Jimenez joins me. He is the director of the Institute for Food and Development Policy, known as Food First, and his new book is A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. It's published by Monthly Review Press. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Yeah, and just to read something from your book that kind of summarizes what you've been talking about, quote, "When we look at the emergence of the capitalist food system, we see that regulation in the form of the enclosures that privatize the production and flow of goods and the violent dispossession of land and resources by state-financed armies, and the exploitation of labor by coercive means such as poverty and slavery allowed the system to emerge. So we've been talking about the first food regime, the colonial food regime, and you write that in the early 20th century, the first regime was replaced with a second global food regime. What happened during World War I and after to kind of shake things up?
Yeah, wars, particularly global wars, have a habit of really shaking up food regimes. So, you know, what happened is in the United States, after colonization and after independence and after the Civil War and the 13th Amendment and the liberation of enslaved people in the United States, is that steadily we begin to increase our productive capacity. And, of course, the dispossession of indigenous lands and the slaughter of indigenous people continues apace as we spread across the continent. And this provides a tremendous sort of natural capital subsidy to the United States. Slavery has already provided tremendous, tremendous wealth to the financial system in the United States, and the government is able to borrow that in order to finance armies who are in the armies, mostly dispossessed peasants from Europe. Anyways, we get this tremendous expansion and steady rise in productivity up to the point of the early 1900s. And in the early 1900s, when, you know, close to 80% of our population was rural, farmers were actually politically very powerful. It was called at that time the Golden Age of agriculture because farmers got prices which were commensurate with, you know, a good living wage. And it was called parity. And farmers basically had parity. Then comes the First World War, which was fought amongst the European colonial powers. The United States pretty much stayed out of it for the early period. And Europe buys steel from the United States, buys a lot of food from the United States. And so farming starts to boom. Farmers are actually getting rich. And then they take that money and they put it in the bank. And then the banks are flush with money from both Europe and the rural sector itself. Well, that's called a crisis of accumulation. The bank has to reinvest that money because they have to pay interest on that money. So they invested in agriculture. And so the price of land begins to skyrocket because it's so valuable, because you make so much money and you can borrow so much on it. So farmers took out, you know, one, two, three, four mortgages on their land and bought more land and produced more. And everybody was really getting rich until the armistice was signed, and then the party was over. Because very soon after that, Europe began to produce food again, and prices crashed. And it's not just that prices crashed for food, but for all of the other products which we had been selling Europe, and all the other products which we had been making for our own armed forces, which really got our economy moving. And that's when we get the 1929 crash.
Which must have added insult to injury at that point for farmers.
Yeah, well, they were the first crash. They were the crash before the crash because their prices evaporated. And they desperately, this is the problem with farming, is that you have high fixed costs. And so if you go into debt one year because prices go down, the next year you don't cut back on production. You've got to pay that debt. And so farmers try to farm their way out of debt by planting more. But if everybody's got a debt, and everybody's planting more because prices are low, all that does is crash the market. So farmers tried to establish forms of, you know, cartels for, you know, milk or wheat or beef or whatever, and they just couldn't do it. They're too far flung. They aren't organized enough. And in and of themselves, they weren't able to avoid the crash of agriculture, which preceded the 1929 crash. So it all came to a very inglorious end.
And then after the Great Depression, of course, we saw the New Deal in the U.S. You associate the dawn of the second global food regime with the New Deal.
Yes, absolutely. Because, you know, the government steps in to do what people can't do on their own. and what farmers as business people can't do on their own, and as producers can't do on their own. So the government steps in and institutes the New Deal. Well, the first part of the New Deal started with the food system. And the first was to ensure close to parity prices for farmers. So guaranteed price, build up grain reserves to maintain prices stable. If the prices go down too low, you buy up grain and put it in reserve and it raises prices. If prices are up too high, you release some grain on the market. It lowers prices, keep that stable. Farmers like that. And then they limited production. There were essentially quotas. You could only produce so much, and you were paid not to produce so that you wouldn't crash the market, so that the 1929-28 crash wouldn't repeat itself. And then with the surplus, which is being stored, the government gave away the food to poor people. Now, this didn't completely solve the problem, and we hear about the bread lines knee-deep in wheat as the United States was trying to pull itself out of the recession. But this introduces a new, completely new stage of state involvement in agriculture. And it's very clear that agriculture is critical to the general economic recovery of the nation. And again, we begin to enter into this area of increased productivity and agricultural expansion right on through to the Second World War. And this is the second food regime, which ends up producing so much food that after the Second World War, sort of the history repeats itself. U.S. gets in late to the into the action and makes a lot of money before the war selling to Europe. But then after the war, Europe is destroyed, but the productive capacity in the United States has not been touched at all. In fact, it's increased, both in terms of agriculture and everything else. So we turn swords into plowshares. Turn the nitrates into fertilizers, we turn the poison gas into pesticides, and we turn the tanks into tractors. And we begin to produce tremendous amounts of food. We include these in the Marshall Plan, and we feed Europe. Of course, Europe is borrowing all this money. But the next stage, then, we loan money to Europe so they can buy our equipment. So Europe modernizes its agricultural sector and begins to overproduce food, right, when the U.S. is overproducing food. So what are we going to do with all this food? And the answer was development. We decided to save the world from hunger, and we began to ship food overseas as food aid, which was then sold, actually, in countries, poor countries, at prices which were below the cost of production in those countries, which put their local farmers out of business. And what we had then is a reversal. If the colonial food regime, the flow of food went from south to north, now the flow of food is going from north to south. In order for that to happen, they had to destroy the food systems, the markets and food systems in the south, in order to absorb the tremendous surplus which was being produced in the north.
Eric Holt Jimenez is his name. He directs the Institute for Food and Development Policy. He's the author of Campesino a Campesino, Voices from Latin America's Farmer-to-Farmer Movement for Sustainable Agriculture, and co-author of Food Rebellions, Crisis and the Hunger for Justice. We are talking about his new book. It's called A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. We'll take a short music break and speak more with Eric about his very interesting book. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. again. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Eric Holt Jimenez is my guest. For more than two decades, he worked with peasant movements in Mexico and Central America. He's the author and co-author and editor of many books about food movements and land justice and food rebellions. And he directs the Institute for Food and Development Policy, also known as Food First. It's an Oakland-based organization that works to end the injustices that cause hunger. His new book is A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. There's so much in just this first chapter, Eric, that we're going to skip around a little bit. But the Green Revolution, which lasted from 1960 to 1990, it was a campaign to spread capitalist agriculture to the countries of the global south. So how much of this has to do with exporting farming-related inputs like fertilizers and pesticides and farm equipment to poorer countries, poorer nations?
Well, it has everything to do with that. And much less to do with ending hunger, as it was sold as the way to end hunger. And what we've seen with the Green Revolution, regardless of the Nobel Prizes that have been given away to some of the authors of the Green Revolution for ending hunger or saving a billion people from hunger, what we see, and this is sort of Food First's trademark, is that the Green Revolution produced as many or more hungry people than it saved. And, you know, the story has been very well documented. Ford and Rockefeller got together, so think about oil and machinery, and realized that neither Europe nor the U.S. could absorb any more of these products. Farmers had bought everything they possibly could. It's almost like food, you know. Once you're satiated, you can't really eat anymore. Mm. And they couldn't buy any more pesticides or fertilizers or new seeds or new tractors. It just wasn't feasible. So they decided to export, find a way to export these goods. And the first thing they did was they hired a man named Carl Sauer, who was a anthropologist here at the University of California, Berkeley, very renowned anthropologist who knew Mexico, certainly, backwards and forwards. They told Carl to go down and do a study on hunger in Mexico and how U.S. technology could solve the problem of hunger by raising yields. He did go down, and when he came back, he basically said they're doing fine. They have some infrastructure problems, and they have some difficulties in moving food from one place to another, but actually they have a very resilient food system. They have hundreds of different varieties of maize and beans and cultivars to feed themselves. They have an extensive ejido system in which farmers gain access to land and have land security in order to produce these crops. They have, on and on and on. They sort of kind of had a New Deal plus going on in Mexico as a result of the Mexican Revolution. And he said, basically, stay away. You guys could probably do more damage than good. So they didn't like that answer, and they hired someone who would give them the answer they wanted, and that man was Norman Borlaug. He was a crop scientist from the Midwest. He went down and said, oh, we can fix this. And that's where he began developing dwarf wheats and whatnot that responded well to high applications of fertilizer and irrigation and to machinery. So the Green Revolution in the first instance is implemented on the best land in Mexico and the best land in India, also in the Punjab, and has spectacular results. You know, they raise productivity, and then banks loan money from the U.S. to governments in the global south so that they can buy these new products. So it very quickly began to displace peasant agriculture again, very much like the high farming did back during the time of the enclosures. And the peasantry isn't able to afford these things, and so is steadily displaced, and larger plantations are established and consolidated. And then when the large landowners could no longer absorb all of these products, the Green Revolution shifted gears.
Right. They shifted gears, if I understand the book correctly, toward allowing peasant farmers to buy these inputs by lending them money.
Precisely. And this is really a big deal because, you know, before to borrow money, you needed to have collateral. And most peasants didn't have collateral. Many of them didn't own the land that they were on, or this was ejido land, which you can't use for collateral. This was all changed. And they just loaned the money directly to peasants and counted on the harvest for paying back. But this completely transforms peasant agriculture. For one thing, peasant agriculture was very agroecological. They had a lot of different cultivars growing at the same time in one place, very complicated crop associations that built resilience into the system. Well, with the Green Revolution, you buy one seed and you grow it on the entire plot. So even things as simple as the three sisters, corn, beans, and squash, was effectively prohibited. If you took out a loan and bought these seeds, you were not allowed to grow corn, beans, and squash. You could only grow the corn. So farmers did this. You know, they had already been displaced from the best lands to the poorest lands. So with this second iteration of the Green Revolution, and poor farmers are provided with the inputs, remember that we've almost doubled the amount of land under cultivation. So we have tremendous, tremendous flush of food on the market. And whenever that happens, the markets crash. And that's exactly what happened. The markets begin to crash. Peasants go out of business. Then, of course, the land consolidates again.
Yeah, and although you, as you indicated, initially yields were increased, yields from these fields and farms were increased, and there was a glut of basic grains as a consequence, there were impacts on the land, right, from synthetic fertilizer application and pesticide application and the planting of these hybrid seeds. What happened to the land?
Yeah, well, what happens is that because peasants are marginalized onto fragile lands, and this can be hillsides, forest frontiers, on the edges of deserts or arid areas, very quickly fertilizers burn up the organic matter in the soil, particularly in the tropics where the solar radiation is so much stronger that the metabolic processes are accelerated. So you lose your natural fertility very quickly. So then you have to add more fertilizer. And the more you add, sort of the worse it gets until you have essentially a mineral soil. That's exactly what happened to the peasantry. On the other hand, then, the minute you institute monocultural agriculture, when you grow only one crop, what you're doing is creating sort of a petri dish for pests. And they multiply rapidly, and then you've got to add more pesticides, and that just kills all of the beneficial insects and the predator insects, and so you get more pests. And it's called the agricultural treadmill or the chemical treadmill. And it's one thing to be on that treadmill if you're a big farmer, because you usually get bailed out with subsidies or forgiveness. But when you're a peasant farmer, no one bails you out. And so peasants were going broke, both because of the structure of the market, but also because of the ecological impact of the inputs they were being sold.
So the Green Revolution, you write, lasted until 1990. You also write about a third food regime, today's corporate food regime, which was built on the two food regimes that preceded it. So what's the relationship between the Green Revolution and the corporate food regime? And what do we need to know about the corporate food regime, the regime that exists and is hegemonic today?
What happens is that remember that the Green Revolution was a government-sponsored campaign. So these are public monies which go in to develop a far-flung network of international research centers for agricultural research. It's called CGIAR. So tremendous amounts of public money is plowed into the Green Revolution, really for the benefit primarily of large seed companies and fertilizer companies and farm machinery companies. But this exhausts itself. First, it exhausts itself ecologically because it's destroying the soil and destroying the agroecosystems and surrounding environments. And so the returns to the Green Revolution are fewer and fewer, and there's less and less interest on the part of government to fund this campaign. But then it also exhausts itself because basically the New Deal capitalism exhausts itself. And we enter into a period of neoliberalization starting in the late 80s, or starting in the 80s, with Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan beginning to roll back all of the social aspects of our governments and privatize everything. Well, this happened even more intensely in the global south, which has to do with the debt crisis, both in farming and of the global south in general. But the way to privatize then shifts not just the agriculture, but shifts entire societies, because what happens is that the global south was loaned money from private banks in the north to develop their forces of production. This very much included agriculture. But then when capitalism enters into a phase of overproduction and these products lose their value, the banks in the north decide they're going to call in their loans. And that's where we get the third world debt crisis, because countries can't afford to pay. That's also where we lose half of the farmers in the United States, because farmers go broke because they can't afford to pay, because their products are not worth anything either. So we get tremendous consolidation in the north. But in the south, how are you going to foreclose on Mexico? So that's when the structural adjustment policies were invented. So the World Bank would come in and say, you're behind on your payments. We'll loan you more money for your payments, but you have to sign a contract with this guy over here. And he was always a guy. And that was the International Monetary Fund. And the International Monetary Fund imposed structural adjustments. And these, for agriculture, were devastating. Because the first thing they said was, you must dismantle all of your grain reserves. You have to reevaluate your currency. You must put up all of your government agencies and programs for sale. And, of course, agriculture during the Green Revolution depended on all of these agencies in order to extend its products. So we move into the next food regime in which agricultural ministries, for example, are almost completely privatized, which means that the peasantry is abandoned because larger farmers can afford to pay experts and extensionists, and the peasantry cannot. Food becomes very complicated. It's not just flowing north to south. It's flowing north to south, south to north, east to west. You have the vast, far-flung complexes like the grain oilseed livestock complex, where grains are grown in the Argentine pampas, and then they're turned into feed somewhere in the Midwest. And then we plow that into, the hog and chicken farms and the big CAFOs, confined animal feedlot operations. And then we export that meat all over the world. So it gets very, very complicated, becomes completely corporatized. And we come into what we call either the corporate food regime or the neoliberal food regime, which is what we have today.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Eric Holt Jimenez is my guest in studio. He is the executive director of the Institute for Food and Development Policy, or Food First. His new book is A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. So there's much more in this book, an extraordinary amount of information offered in this book, A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism. But I want to turn to what you see as possible changes within the food system, changes to the corporate food regime, who might do this, how it might be done, what specifically needs to be done. So there is a food movement out there, a very active food movement on many different levels. What do you think, kind of in general terms, about where the food movement, what kind of change the food movement might be able to effect?
Well, the first thing we have to realize is that the corporate food regime is a capitalist food regime. And so it's going to act the way capitalism acts. And we know some things about capitalism. We've been studying it for over 300 years. And Karl Polanyi documented how capitalism goes through different phases, different periods. It bounces back and forth between periods of liberalism and periods of reform. And when he says liberalism, he means market liberalization.
Gotcha.
Taking the gloves off the market, no regulation. And you come into a period of tremendous concentration of wealth, but also into a period in which society is completely exposed to the market. People are unprotected by their governments from the volatility and the violence of the market. And so historically what people have done is they rise up and they fight back. They make things so uncomfortable that, in fact, they forced reformists to institute reforms. This usually happens after a big crash, when people are miserable. So we thought that this might have happened when we had the stock market crash here, in the financial crash in 2008, 2009, but nothing changed. In effect, the banks got bailed out, and that was it. There were no reforms. And what was the difference? The difference was that there was not a strong counter-movement. There was a social movement so strong that they could create political will to institute reforms, make the politicians do the right thing. Otherwise, they just do the thing that capital demands. And I think that when you look around the world, you see counter-movements growing. And the food movement is, I believe, one of the prominent counter-movements to capitalism, and it's a counter-movement to the corporate food regime. And neither the corporate food regime nor the food movement is monolithic. There's a lot of diversity in both, but there are some trends, some very identifiable trends. So if the corporate food regime has a neoliberal wing, which is now quite hegemonic, they also have a reformist wing, which is now quite weak. Food movements have a very progressive wing that is really grappling with the day-to-day difficulties of the food system. So that's where we see, you know, organic farmers, community agriculture, food policy councils, farm-to-school programs, all this plethora of, you know, fascinating responses to the injustices and the inadequacy of the corporate food regime, of our food systems. These are very practical folks.
Would you call them reformist? Are they pushing for reforms to the food system?
You know, primarily, I think the progressives are the doers. They're not terribly political, although we're beginning to see differences there. And as such, they're very easily co-opted by reformists from within the corporate food regime. I mean, there's quite a bit of money there, for one thing, and most community organizations don't have money. And so, you know, most of the sort of reformist foundations and reformist wings of government, you know, attempt to establish alliances with progressives because the reformists are weak.
And what do the reformists within the corporate food regime, what do they want?
Well, they basically want the same thing as the neoliberals, except they want safety nets. So, you know, EBT, you know, food stamps would be a safety net which reformists would defend, whereas neoliberals want to do away with it. Both believe in the food enterprise system, and they both believe in sort of the formula of overproduction and for getting things done. And they both believe in the power of corporations to solve the world's problems without really seeing how corporations themselves are the problem.
So what do you think of the tendency of the progressive trend within the food movement, or a significant part of it, to ally themselves with reformists?
Well, I think that it's a big mistake, because basically you're going to be reinforcing the corporate food regime. That's where they come from. I think that progressives are actually very pivotal. If they throw their weight and their alliances towards reformists, I believe the corporate food regime is strengthened. But if they throw their weight to who I'm calling the radicals, it's a different story. Because you think about the more radical trends within the food movement, these are the folks who want to change the rules and the institutions. They want agriculture out of the World Trade Organization. They want land reform. They want to dismantle the power of monopolies and corporate power. So they're really looking at the structures of capitalism, whereas the progressives are looking at the practices of farming. If these two are able to form strategic alliances, and I think we already see this happening, then the food movement is strengthened as a counter movement. And we know historically that the only way reforms will ever be introduced are through strong, powerful counter movements. And certainly if we're thinking about not just reforming the system to stabilize it, but transforming the system, then we really need to build these strong strategic alliances between the progressive and radical sectors of the food movement.
Within these sectors, there are a lot of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, CBOs, community-based organizations. What is it about the funding of these groups that might encourage or discourage a turn toward a radical agenda, a turn toward an agenda that includes changing things on a fundamental level?
Well, in a word, the foundations. I mean, the funding. The left has been fragmented, both because of its own errors, but also because of the money that it's received from foundations. The foundations, the whole structure of foundations and charities is to, fund specific organizations, fund their SMART objectives and their, sort of quantifiable results, and not to fund, a more transformative movement-building activities. And so what this does is it pits community organizations against each other. We're all competing for funding when we should be working together. But we have no choice because we have no money, and the only place to get the money is from the foundations. And certainly there are a number of family foundations, I think, that recognize this and do try to support movement-building activities and alliances. But in general, what we have seen for decades now is the fragmentation of the left.
Eric Holt Jimenez joins us to talk about his new book, A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. I'm C.S. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You believe that the food movement can only succeed, the counter-movement can only succeed, if it builds a critical public sphere. What do you mean by that?
We often don't think about the public sphere anymore, and that's because it's been destroyed. Neoliberalism over the past 30 years has not just privatized our public services, it's destroyed the community relationships that we have, or that we had. This is the public sphere, that part of our society where we come together, we debate, we analyze problems, and we make decisions based on what we collectively believe to be right or to be best. We don't just let the market decide, because if the market decides, that means that whoever has the most market power is going to be making the decisions, and we know who that is. Those are the corporations. So it's no mistake that the public sphere has been decimated over the last 30 years. I talk to my students sometimes, and they don't know what a public sphere is. They're astounded to know that I went all the way through college and got my master's and my PhD without any debt whatsoever, through public scholarships, that there was public housing. And so part of our fragmentation under this supposed, entrepreneurial society that we have is our powerlessness and the illusion that we have powers as individuals when, in fact, we don't. We're completely being manipulated. And so reconstructing the public sphere, I think, is the first step towards building the social and political power that we need in order to change the food system. And I'll just give you a small example of where this is happening. The food policy councils. We have one here in Berkeley. We have one in Oakland and Richmond. And there are hundreds of them across the United States and Canada and in Australia, and they're popping up in Europe. So in the United States, it's really hard to change the laws and institutions around our food regime. You've got the Farm Bill. It's insulated by layer after layer of committee. They're not going to let any citizen touch that thing. That's for the politicians and the corporations to decide. But it sets the rules, and it sets the price of grain worldwide. Well, we can't change that today. We try and we try and we try, and there are basically no changes there. But we can change the food system at the local level. And so food policy councils are doing exactly that, bringing citizens together from all walks of life, small businesses, churches, the health sector, public health, et cetera. And they come together, analyze problems, and begin to advance policies, rules, and institutions that help to humanize our food systems. And I'm very proud of the food policy councils here in the Bay Area. They've really done tremendous work trying to make land available for cultivation for urban dwellers, finding ways so that urban farmers can sell their products, finding ways so that immigrants can start food enterprises, really beginning to see, can we localize our food system and democratize it as much as possible? That's public sphere in action.
How crisis-ridden is neoliberal capitalism today, and how important is it that the food movement and other movements mobilize, particularly now, to take advantage of the situation?
We see plenty of crises, food crises, even though we produce 1.5 times more than enough food for everybody. We've got close to 2 billion people going hungry. And we have, 1 in 7 going hungry in this country, richest country in the world. That doesn't seem to affect Wall Street at all. And, of course, we've got the global warming, and agriculture and the food system contribute anywhere from 20 to 40% of the greenhouse gases, either whether it's nitrous or whether it's carbon. So the crises are certainly here. And, in the past, when we were able to institute reforms, there was a crash, crises, a crash, and there was a threat. And the threat before was communism. And so Roosevelt institutes reforms in order to keep the United States from going communist. This time I think the threat is global warming. And you can't establish detente with global warming. So we may be at the end of the line here. This might be the time where the concerns around food and the concerns around climate may well converge, and the crises around food and climate may well converge in such a way that we can get some real political traction and social traction to force changes upon the system.
Can what you call a good, clean, and fair food system, can that be constructed within capitalism?
Well, I think we have to look at the history. And, what people who say that are basically proposing is that we fix the food system. And if you want to fix the food system, you have to ask, well, that means it's broken, but when did it actually work well? It certainly didn't work well when we dispossessed indigenous peoples of their land and engaged in mass genocide. That didn't work too well for indigenous people. It didn't work well for enslaved Africans. Certainly has not worked well for immigrant farm workers. So I don't think we can fix this broken food system. It's not broken. It's a capitalist food system. It's working exactly as a capitalist food system is supposed to work. It concentrates wealth and it offloads all of the externalities to the public, the vulnerable public. And that's what it's doing today. So no, I think the question to be asked is, it means we have to change everything. If we want to change the food system, we have to change everything. I think that because of the historic relationship of capitalism and our food system, they have co-evolved. If you change the food system, you're going to be introducing forcibly changes into capitalism. And then I think we also have to act to change capitalism itself in order to be able to change the food system that we have. So it's very much a dialectical process. It sounds daunting and overwhelming, and it is. And we don't know if this is going to work. We don't know how things are going to turn out. But we would know how things turn out if we do nothing, which I think we're heading for destruction.
Eric Holt Jimenez, Executive Director of the Institute for Food and Development Policy, known as Food First. Again, it's an organization that works to end the injustices that cause hunger. And we've been discussing his new book. It's called A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. Congratulations, Eric, on this book, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, C.S. A pleasure to be with you.
And that interview first aired on January 23rd of this year. And this is C.S. suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.